And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to spend a lot of time talking about education. Yes, yes, the future of our country relies on it. Our children's future demand that we, right now, make a choice. Do we give more to the very well-to-do, or do we invest in the future? That is one of the questions. Also going to talk about the war on workers, as a number of, and good on these folks out in Cranberry Township, who went out to visit the representative Daryl Metcalf, the Mad Cow, who said, look, you know, hey, we want to destroy workers' rights. So the workers went to his office today. We're going to find out what happened. Also, in the second hour, we're going to talk with Dr. Stephen Herzenberg of the Keystone Research Center about the governor's pension proposal. Is this a good idea, bad idea? We're told, and this is what I keep seeing, that the governor is going to take money away from the teachers' pensions to add a little bit to education, you know, the $1 billion that he gutted out of it. I'm going to add a little bit back because, you know, hey, it is an election year. So we're going to talk about that, find out, you know, is it a good idea? Yeah. And this idea of moving from a defined benefit to a defined contribution, good, bad, or just plain horrible? And in the third hour, we're going to talk with John Micek, editorial and opinion editor over at Penn Live, about the press conference rally, the number of folks who got to the Capitol to talk about House Bill 1507 and Senate Bill 1034. Hope you have called your representatives, because this poison affects all of us. It may sound innocuous. It may sound, oh, it's not that big of a deal. It's poison, pure and simple, bottom line. And that's why I'm glad to see that the city council in Philadelphia passed a resolution today standing against dark money, standing against the Koch brothers and the Alex and the Freedom Works and all of these huge public, these huge special interests to attack teachers and nurses, social workers and cops and firefighters. Oh, I know, Rick, but they're not going after cops and firefighters yet. Key word in that sentence, I believe, yet. But good on them. The city council in Philadelphia passed this resolution saying, you know what, we're not gonna stand with it. We're not going to be a party to this. And as they point out, this is something that's been in place for years. What you're now doing is radical change. And they pointed out in their resolution that 1507 and Senate Bill 1034, spuriously known as Harrisburg as paycheck protection, aims solely to take away the ability of public sector unions to collectively bargain for the employer to make automatic deductions. And you know, you can go, hey, you know, it's a huge expense, Rick. Didn't you hear? It's an enormous expense. It's huge money. It's so much that they don't even do a study to tell you how much it is. Well, wait a second. If it's what? Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And you know, down the road, bottom line, this is about silencing citizens. Pure and simple. There's nothing good here, in my view. Anyway, if you've got any thoughts, questions, comments, whatever is on your mind tonight, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Or you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. When you call, going to get an automated message. I'm running the board here, so it'll take a minute for me to get to you, but please hang on the line. Another thing I'm going to spend some time on over the next couple of weeks is this, and pretty much what we've been talking about on this program from its inception, the gulf between those who have and those who don't, especially when you're talking about people who are working 40 hours a week, people who are busting their behinds and still falling behind. And, you know, with the President's State of the Union address, I think it could have been much, much more powerful, a much bigger call to action, a rallying cry. Really, I mean, you know, a change in course. The marching orders that, you know, you go, hey, this is what we should be doing. Because, you know, what we realize is that the top 1% has done wildly well. Wildly well. And look, if everyone else was doing well too, if we didn't have children going hungry, if we didn't have people dying because they don't have health insurance, If we don't have homeless people freezing on the streets, then I say, fine, go make your money. But we have all those things and more. So when you see from 1979 to 2007, during that window, which is the Reagan era, really, it's the whole push towards lower taxes, deregulation, destruction of unions. It's this whole conservative push. And I don't even know conservative is the corporatist is more the right word. The corporatists have taken over the conservative movement. And in that time frame, the top 1% has seen an increase in their after-tax real income of 278%. And you go, well, you know, hey, did I get an increase over that period of 278%? No. If you're someone who's fortunate enough to be in the middle class, that middle 60%, you know, somewhere in that big middle area, you saw less than 40% over that time frame. Less than 40% growth in your wages. And in fact, you know, a number of folks actually fell backwards. I mean, you're talking about a huge section, like 60%. There's some at the very top, even in that gulf, that are going to do better than the folks at the bottom. And, you know, I would say if you actually work for a living, you punch a clock and you get your hands dirty, you've seen your wages go down precipitously over the last 15, 16, 18 years. It's just how it is. And now you look at the CEO pay, especially on Wall Street. Wow. Never better. Never better. And some of the lowest tax rates in history. Never better. And you go, well, you know, that's just how capitalism works. No, that's what happens when you rig the game. And understand, this massive income inequality is dangerous. It's dangerous to a country when you have a large number of people who are well over their head in debt, either with credit cards or mortgages or you name it. When you have a nation that is indebted, you have a civilization full of people who are, okay, whatever I got to do to stay on the treadmill, not willing to fight, not willing to take to the streets. And then you look at the income inequality as it comes to health care. And what I give Obama credit for is pushing this Affordable Care Act to get people a little bit of health care, a little health security. Because, you know, in my view, you can't be anywhere near the middle class without that type of health security, without a little retirement security. And I came across an interesting number that, you know, from the Harvard School of Public Health, who pointed out that life expectancy of male workers who retire at 65 has grown by 6 years in the top half of the economic distribution, but only 1.3 years in the bottom half over the last 30 years. And if you take that the next step further, once you get into the top 10%, the top 1%, that goes even further beyond, because you've got the money to be able to afford preventative care, and you've got the money to be able to afford when you get sick, you go right to the doctor. I got your own personal doctor. And again, part of what I like about the Affordable Care Act is it gives people the opportunity to get a little preventative health care. And there's a whole bunch of other things when you start talking about mass inequality. Harvard also analyzed the homicide rates in D.C., in the District of Columbia. And they found that income inequality alone accounted for 74% of the variance in murder rates and half of aggravated assaults. Because if you live in a poor neighborhood, you live in a desperate neighborhood, these kind of things happen. And when I was a kid, I remember a number of times. You come home and come through the back door and somebody's climbing out the front window. When I was a kid, we got robbed numerous times. And the thing is, we didn't have anything. I mean, that's the sad thing. When it was the beginning of the month and there was some food in the house, that's what they came for. And what's that say about society when we're robbing each other just to feed ourselves? And I'm down the list. I mean, you know, when you have this gulf between the haves and haves, have-nots, you end up with a less democratic society. You end up with the Koch brothers having $400 million to spend on getting their way. You have the Sheldon Adelsons of the world spending $100 million on a presidential candidate to get his way. And what are their way? What do they want? Well, they want more. It doesn't get any simpler than that. And the reality is when you have a system that is so stacked against the working people, when you have this massive inequality. And I guess the best way, and you know, some people say, well, you know, we're going to have an unequal society. That's just the way things are. When you have this kind of disparity in wealth, when you have so few with so much and so many without, you're just purely from an economic standpoint. Don't get into the morality. Don't get into the emotion or any of that stuff. Get into the pure economics of it. When the vast majority of your people don't have anything to play in the game with, who controls the game? And, you know, the analogy's always been out there. One guy with $1 billion or, you know, 1,000 people with $1 million. What's better for the economy? Well, the one guy's not going to spend $1 billion. But the 1,000 people probably might spend a good bit of money and create more jobs and more economic activity. That seems the way we should be looking. But again, when you have the few with so much and in so control of the message, do you ever get that? I mean, I'm hopeful. I think in all of the times that I've been doing this program on the air, I see people finally starting to talk about things that we've been talking about here on the program. But how do we make sure our kids get a good education? After this governor has been gutting tons of money, $1 billion each of the last 3 years, people are going, hey, wait a minute. I'm concerned about that. When they see the roads and the conditions of the bridges and they see the infrastructure and they see more homeless people, they start going, what's going on here? What is it that our government is not doing? And for me, it comes down to the person who's sitting in the governor's mansion. The guy who sets the tone, who makes the call, who points the finger. And next Tuesday, I think it is, next Tuesday when the governor gives his State of the State, we'll hear about the budget. We will see what his priorities are. Will they be just election year talking points? Or is he going to make some real investments? It will be very interesting to see where this all goes. I've got to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. President Obama could have done much more for working people in his State of the Union speech. AFL-CIO Chief Economist William Spriggs, speaking on Washington, D.C.'s We Act Radio, says if Obama is serious about addressing income inequality, he has to be serious about reversing decades of policies that helped create it.
It was a little disappointing because the president said, look, we didn't get into this situation yesterday or even with the Great Recession. For 30 years before then, we had rising inequality. But then he blamed it on technology and global competition. Global competition, yes, but he could have mentioned bad trade deals. Mm-hmm. It's really policy that got us in this situation, and that was the moment to say, so we have to reverse the policies.
Spriggs says Obama should not be shy about asserting government's role of advocating for working people.
Government needs to be on the side of the people. This needs to be government for the people. One of the things is that government can be for you having higher wages, and we have to back away from thinking government can't be for the people. I mean, he's doing an executive order on the minimum wage. He could have done an executive order talking about employers following the National Labor Relations Act. He could have talked about more good things that employers should do if they're going to be government contractors. So there was a lot more room for him to talk about those institutions and those things that matter, like unions.
We Are One Illinois is suing the state over pension cuts for public workers, alleging the cuts to cost of living increases and raising retirement ages is unconstitutional. We Are One Illinois includes the state AFL-CIO, AFSCME, SEIU, Illinois Federation of Teachers, and the Illinois Education Association. Workers held up their end of the pensions bargain by putting in the labor and in some cases foregoing wage increases to maintain a good pension system for decades. Politicians, though, shortchanged the workers for decades by not properly funding the pension system. So Illinois is facing a $100 billion 30-year unfunded pension liability. The state's solution was to renege on the pension promise and to cut the benefits. The state constitution prohibits diminishing, though, of public worker pensions. Illinois AFL-CIO President Michael Kerrigan says the state is engaging in pension theft that is not only unfair but unconstitutional. In a letter to Congress, Christian leaders are joining the call to extend unemployment benefits. The group includes the National Council of Churches. Jim Winkler is council president. He says Scripture repeatedly calls for national leaders to care for those in need, and this is a moment for our nation's leaders to choose to provide assistance to the jobless.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we've put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education like better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
Yes, what a wonderful world indeed. What a wonderful it would be if we just ran everything like a business, ran everything like corporate America would do. So when your kids are, you know, 30 cents short on their school lunch, we just take it and throw it in the trash, right? Like they did back in November in Texas. And now you see in Salt Lake City, Utah, the Utah Elementary School, according to Salt Lake Tribune, the manager of the child nutrition program was angry, I guess, that the kids' parents hadn't paid or were behind or whatever. There wasn't enough money in there, so they weren't going to let the kids have lunch, but the school cafeteria people said, we're going to give it, dished it out anyway. Now, the law says, I guess, once you've dished it out, you can't serve it to somebody else. So they took the lunches from these kids and in front of them and in front of everyone threw it in the trash. Is that what we're going to do? Now, parents obviously were outraged. They called the event traumatic and humiliating, and I gotta be honest, I agree. Personally, I think we should all be doing like Boston is doing, the Boston Public School, which is saying, you know what, everybody who comes to school is going to get breakfast, going to get lunch. Nobody's going to have to come and look at the sofa cushions for change. We're going to make sure that they get fed because we know that's going to help them learn. Jeez, this is what happens when you partner with private people. Jeez. Anyway, here to talk a little bit about the state of education here in Pennsylvania. Also, maybe a little bit about the State of the Union address, a couple other things. I've asked Ted Kirsch. He is the president of the American Federation of Teachers here in Pennsylvania. Ted, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me on again, Rick.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, this idea, like Sue Helm said there at the opening, we need to be partnering with private people so that we end up with outcomes like kids getting their lunches thrown away because they didn't have 30 cents.
You know what? It's just unimaginable when you hear about these things. Where is the common sense? What's happened to people that get put in these positions that lose sight of what their job really is?
Well, I think the job really is making money. And the sad reality, Ted, is I'm looking across the country, and I'm sure you know better than anyone, as we're moving towards privatizing public education, not just here in Pennsylvania, but all across the country, when the bean counters come in and take over, this is the kind of stuff you get. And I worry about, you know, hey, I grew up in a housing project in the west side of Cleveland. What would have my education looked like?
You probably wouldn't have had an education had they had their way, because what's happening with privatization today is the destruction and I use that word advisedly, of public education. It's starving it, taking away what we need to give every kid an equal opportunity in this country. And isn't that what the president was saying the other day?
Now,
that everybody should have an equal opportunity.
Absolutely. And, you know, what I see here in Pennsylvania, this governor that we have, and not somebody that I voted for, to be honest, but $1 billion.
On this call.
$1 billion each of the last three years away from education. And it's no wonder, if you looked at the FNM poll today, that 19% approval rating.
And he still goes on with what he believes is best, but not what the people in this Commonwealth think is best. You mean, he's pushing privatization. He's pushing getting rid of state stores to affect the lottery. That's not what concerns the people in this Commonwealth. It's education. It's jobs. It's the economy. That's what people are interested in. He doesn't even deal with it.
Yeah. It's all of this divisive stuff, and I got to be honest with you. I talk to teachers all the time, and I give you guys nothing but the utmost respect and credit, because I don't know that I would be willing to take the abuse and the constant attacks that I see coming from one of the parties in our political sphere, if it's not, you know, saying that there are bad teachers out there, or saying that, you know, there are lazy teachers or greedy ones because of these gilded pensions. I don't know how you get up every day and do it. It would make me angry, and I guess that's why I'm not a teacher.
Well, the truth of the matter is people are getting angry. And statistically, we can say, and I'll just talk about, you know, Philadelphia as an example, but I know this pattern is following throughout the state, that within the first 5 years of people teaching, more than half are leaving. When I became a teacher, and I know it's a different generation, but it was a career, it was a commitment. The abuse that people are taking today in this profession is uncalled for. And you know what people are saying? Hey, I don't have to take this. Yep. This is not my fault. And they get blamed for everything. And people are leaving the profession, and it only hurts our youngsters in the school, because like a lot of jobs, experience makes you better. And when you first start teaching, as much as we have enthusiasm and excitement, there's a lot we have to learn, and it takes some years till we finally hone the skills that we need to be more successful. And when we find, you know, you mentioned some teachers that aren't, are having some trouble, we should have a commitment to helping those people, to give them training, staff development, assistance, to make them better teachers. Not just throw them out, let's get rid of them, and start all over again with the same problems. We're not solving anything
right with
this direction.
But don't you think, and there's a cynical, jaded part of me that goes, you know, all of this is part of the scheme to privatize and, of course, to profitize our education system. It's really not about saving the future for our kids. It's about money, and I hate to say that, but that's what it seems like to me.
I think it's more than just seems like. When you look at what's happening in this charter school movement, which is really big in the state, and of course there are people that want to make it even bigger, you're talking about money, you're talking about profit. You're not talking about education. Look, the concept of charter schools, which originally came from a friend of mine, Albert Schenker, the late great president of the American Federation of Teachers, he said they should be houses of innovation.
Yes.
Let's try to make things better. That was the concept of the charter schools. But it has been twisted and turned into a business, and it's destroying many, many children.
And if you go back and you look at Senate Bill 1085, which we've talked about in the past, one of the things that the 1085 does is it takes out that concept that you articulated there completely out of the law. This idea that there to be laboratories of innovation takes that right out of it and just says, you know what, we didn't believe that when we put it in, and now it's just what it is. It's how much can we make off of it.
And that's exactly what's happening. People should look at the profit and loss of the charter schools. But what's happening is they're hiding it. They don't want the public to know. And they're saying, well, we have all these rules for public school, but, oh, they don't apply to the charter schools or private schools. They hold us to a different standard. They're getting away with murder.
So how do we stop it? I mean, you know, I saw the president in the State of the Union address the other day. He said that teachers and principals in schools from Tennessee to Washington, D.C. are making big strides in preparing students with skills for the new economy. He said problem solving, critical thinking, science, technology, engineering, and math, things I'm all in favor of. He said some of this change is hard. It requires everything from more challenging curriculums and more demanding parents to better support for teachers and new ways of measuring how well our kids think, not how well they fill in a bubble on a test. And when I heard him say that, Ted, I go, have we not been talking to Arne Duncan? Because, you know, it's my view that the last couple of years, these bubble tests seem to be more pervasive.
Well, we have been talking to Duncan, but those of us in the teaching profession know that sometimes you have to say something like seven times before it sinks in.
There you go.
You know what? The president did talk about filling the bubble, but just think about it. We're not teaching as we did generation ago. We're preparing kids to take tests. Now, if you are a businessman and you have a business and there's a problem, are you going to hand your employees a bubble, a test, and say, fill in the bubble to solve the problem? You want that person to be able to think for themselves, to solve the problem. Well, we're not teaching kids that when we stick to these bubble standardized high-stakes tests. You know, education is not a competition. It's not a race. It's a journey.
There you go.
You know, we go step by step. We have to teach kids. And you can't have a focus on the wrong thing. And that's what's happened with the national NCLB, Race to the Top. Nice, fancy titles, but they're missing the point. We're not allowing teachers to do what they do best, and that is teach.
Yeah, I mean,
and the
education.
The president also said about we have to focus in on early childhood education.
Yes.
Talk to any teacher, anyone in education at any level. And they say that when we get these youngsters in kindergarten, they should know certain basic things. They should know their colors. They should know about books. They should be read to. There are so many of our children that are coming to school through no fault of their own without being prepared to do well. And that's why year after year, they're behind and they just keep staying behind. You talk about a dropout rate. There's so many issues you could talk about. The basic bottom line, early childhood education, give every student an opportunity to start out on an equal level. And so many of our students don't have the opportunity to start with an equal level, and they are penalized throughout their entire careers and their lifetimes as well.
Yeah, and society, it's a negative effect on society as well, because, you know, I've seen studies that show every dollar you spend on early childhood education, you end up saving something like seven or eight down the line and lower social spending, lower prison spending, and more taxation from these kids as they get into the workforce and earn more money.
I had a friend many years ago who was an elected official in Philadelphia, and she came out of the coal mining regions of West Virginia. And I just remember her saying one time, we have to educate, not incarcerate.
Yep.
The amount of money that if we were to invest in education would save us a whole lot of money down the line.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Ted Kirsch, president of the American Federation of Teachers here in Pennsylvania. One of the things I did want to ask you about on Tuesday, there was a big press conference, a piece of legislation that a couple of the Republicans here in the Commonwealth decided that they thought was more important than funding education or some of the more important things, what they've dubbed paycheck protection. And I've asked the question, you know, what protection is there? Are you stopping wage theft? Are you stopping overtime theft? Are you stopping any of the abuses that we've seen that seem to be pervasive in some employment sectors? And the answer is no, no, and no. So the question then became, what is it? And I understand you had a bunch of folks there because this is pointed at you.
Well, the bill that is in dispute and under discussion right now is House Bill 1507, which is to take away rights that unions presently have and their members in order to pay their dues. You know, this is an out-and-out attack on trying to weaken unions. And as I was thinking about it, the unions are the voice for the middle class. We're the ones who are fighting, for the most part, for minimum wage, which doesn't affect us. We're fighting for health care, and almost every union contract has health care. If you can weaken the union, you are going to help to destroy the middle class. And those are the people who are not the Tea Party members. They're not the ones that are trying to improve this commonwealth. And today in the Philadelphia Daily News, columnist John Baer pointed out, it's very clear, and I'm quoting, it's clear that this is an attack on unions. He also wrote, the political reality is that troublesome GOP issues, such as selling off state stores, getting school vouchers, or cutting public pensions, could more easily be tackled if not for the influence of, and I'm quoting again, pesky unions. It is clearly an attempt to weaken unions, and in effect, it's not just the unions, it's the middle class, it's the working people of this country this movement is.
Now, I look at it, it's purely Machiavellian politic. We're going to gut our enemy in public. And even at the demise and the destruction of our own friends, neighbors, and family.
Well, they did it in Wisconsin. They tried it unsuccessfully in Ohio. And Pennsylvania is the new target. And the money coming to fund these attacks are coming from the outside. It's from the Koch brothers. It's the members of the ALEC organization or who support ALEC. It's the Commonwealth Foundation. There's a whole right-wing Republican group pouring money in to threaten, and we know this because we've been told, threaten Republican legislators that they'd be challenged. They'll be attacked if they don't vote their way, and they'll pour the money in. But through it all, up to this point, there are a number of legislators, and most of them Republicans, who do not want to be blackmailed and threatened and forced into something that they really don't believe in.
And that's where it takes all of us, calling our legislators and saying, hey, we're behind you. Stand on the right side of this issue. Don't cave. And look, at the end of the day, it's going to take all of us calling and really, like happened on Tuesday, thousands of people flooded the Capitol. I think that sent a very strong message.
You know what? It was cold Tuesday, and among those thousands, many of them couldn't get inside,
yep.
And they still stood out there. And what was real so good about the rally is that a number of state legislators came by, and they saw it and stood with the people. And that rotunda was really filled with people who opposed this Tea Party assault on the middle class.
And I'm told that this may not be the last of it. If this 1507 and 1034, if they continues forward, this could be a common occurrence, is what one person told me. Last line of questioning I wanted to ask you about, though. I saw a story that the governor's budget, obviously going to talk about it on next Tuesday, that they're going to increase a little bit of, just a touch back to education. I've heard somewhere $100 million, $200 million. I've heard, and maybe you can clarify this for me, that they plan on taking it from the teachers' pensions and basically defunding the teachers' pensions again, as we have done probably, 15 of the last 20 years or something like that?
Again, if you look at their strategy, we know that you said it earlier, the $1 billion that was cut 3 years ago, and I'm not a math teacher, I was a history teacher, but if you go 3 years, $1 billion plus $1 billion was $1 billion, that's $3 billion.
Yep.
I don't have any other math cut from public education. So now they say we're going to give some money back, and then we're going to take it from the people who work in the schools, who made a contract that will take less salary. And over the years, everyone knows teachers are not the highest paid, but we understood in this profession that you know, we'll take lower salaries, but we know that eventually we're going to have a decent retirement that's going to make us a nice life when we retire. You're going to now take it away from these people when, in fact, the government, these very same people, did not pay the share that was due to the pension fund? That's what created the problem. They never they increased it. They never put their money in. And therefore, the pension fund's going down, and now they want to attack it and take more out and have people fighting with one another.
See, I would argue, Ted, that this is was the game plan from the beginning. You set it up so that it fails, and then you can go, see, look, it didn't work. We told you government can't do anything. It's part of the MO. It's part of what they do time and time again. And sadly, our media culture lets them get away with it.
Rick, it's very clear there is a solution. And there's three things here that can be done. One, the tax cuts that business are getting. It's enough money to reduce it to put back that $1 billion that was in there. You know, it's tax cuts. It's that Delaware corporate loophole that allows companies to get away. And the third point is we must begin to tax and reasonable the giving away of our natural resources and that shale extraction. The money is there, and instead of going with our natural resources to companies to profiteer, the money should be going to kids to help them have a better life. There are solutions without increasing taxes, without taking money away from pensions. The businesses are getting away with murder, and that's why they support the governor. The people don't support him. Look at the polling data. But the companies do, and they're going to pour all kinds of money in to keep them in office.
And that's why, if you look at the FNM poll, 19% approval rating for this governor. I think people are coming around. I think they're waking up to the realities that this guy's definitely not the education president. He's more the corporate president, more the corporate governor.
There's no question. Now, I don't know what kind of attorney general he was, because nobody was really paying attention. I only know about the Penn State case and what he probably should have done sooner.
Right.
To protect their children. That's a different issue. But that's when he was an attorney general. But as a governor, this man is a disaster and should not be reelected. There's no question about it. And somebody told me today, and I don't know the accuracy, but there was a poll taken. And some unknown person, they gave the name, but I didn't know who he was, in the Republican Party, got like 25% as a support of Republicans. And the man hasn't even announced that he's running to challenge him. That shows how low people in this Commonwealth think of our governor.
I wonder if you put him up against a Pat Rock, how he would do. But, Ted, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us and filling us in. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
I'm always available for you and your listeners, Rick. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks so much. Ted Kirsch, president of AFT Pennsylvania. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
90% of the world. 10% of the people own 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
A corporate lobbyist recently admitted to the New York Times, everybody is embarrassed about it, although not so embarrassed that they don't do it. It is the scandalous copulation between corporate cash and willing legislators that's taking place regularly in such secretive rendezvous resorts as the Dorado Beach Ritz-Carlton. Lawmakers and lobbyists don't like to talk about what they're doing and certainly don't want voters or the media to see them. For these getaways are explicit, tawdry examples of the prostitution of our legislative system. If you had wandered innocently into the Tony Four Seasons Hotel of Vail, Colorado in early January, you could have witnessed one of these group gropes. Assorted lobbyists, including one who represents the utility giant, PPL Corporation, had slipped tens of thousands of dollars into the political pockets of Representative Ed Whitfield and four other House members for the pleasure of rubbing elbows, wining and dining, and whispering sweet legislative nothings to them for hours. At one dinner, the cozy group dug into juicy Wagyu steaks and swilled $60 a bottle wine as they played scratch-my-back Washington-style politics. Whitfield, a Kentucky Republican, was especially popular with the utility lobbyists, for he chairs the House committee that handles legislation affecting, guess who, utilities. And Ed must have had a good time in Vail, because when he returned to Washington, he promptly introduced a bill to let PPL and other electric utilities build additional polluting, coal-burning power plants, an industry favor that would overturn health protections recently approved by the Obama administration. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, the public approval rating for Congress is at historic lows, but the veiled experience of Whitfield and the others just shows that lawmakers can be lovable. You just have to know the price. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, on Tuesday, a huge rally. And, you know, we talked about it yesterday. We talked about it on Tuesday. Thousands of people, a lot of them held out in the cold because the Capitol Police, and I got to say, probably at the behest of our governor, said, we're not letting anybody in. And there were plenty of areas where you could have put people. What I found ironic is you went to the back of the building, you saw the charter school people coming through. That tells me priorities. And what I said is, you know, if you're not going to be able to go see your legislators in the Capitol, in your Capitol, then maybe you got to go to their district offices. And if they're not going to let see it, their district offices, well, maybe we're going to have to go knock on their door at their house. But today, folks out in the Cranberry Township area, where Mad Cow Darrell Metcalf has his district office, there were a number of people that went out and had, well, a couple interesting words and some thoughts for Darrell Metcalf. I've got one of those folks here on the line. Rita Traeger is an RN, also one of the people. She was here Tuesday in Harrisburg and also at Mad Cow's office. Rita, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So you were at Metcalf's office today. What kind of reception did you get?
Well, it was interesting. You know, we went straight to his office, and his staff came to the door, wouldn't allow any of us in. There were about 30 of us there, roughly. And when we asked if he was available, they said he was not, and proceeded to tell us that they knew we were coming. He knew we were coming, and lo and behold, he wasn't there. So,
any surprise in that?
None at all. I don't think anyone was shocked.
At the end of the day, when you look at this kind of stuff, these folks are cowards. They're going to take the Koch brother money. They're going to take the out-of-state money. They're going to push this poison, but they're not going to stand and look you in the face and tell you that they're sticking it to you.
Right.
So did you get any conversation with the staff people? What was their response? I understand Darrell Metcalf is one of the co-sponsors of House Bill 1507, the Paycheck Destruction Deception Act. They call it protection. I haven't seen any protection, but any word from the staff on why, on his thoughts?
No, not really. Actually, they just kind of barricaded the door, wouldn't let any of us in. We then proceeded with we went through everything we wanted to say. At one point, they were actually videotaping us on their cameras. But they didn't really have anything to say other than he wasn't available, and they wouldn't tell us where he was in the district, because we even said we would just go and find him, and he wouldn't, they wouldn't give us his location.
Okay, so let's say Mad Cow's listening here on the program, which I'm told he has listened in the past. What do we tell him? Why is this a bad idea? Why is this something that we know he's co-sponsored, but why shouldn't he?
Well, on my perspective as an RN, I feel it's bad because it makes it just increasingly difficult, if not almost impossible, for us to continue to have a voice. My facility I work at, we're union. I'm very proud of that. Our residents that live there are also happy that we're union, because we've been able to go out and fight for things that directly affect their care, such as staffing, you know, ending mandatory overtime. You know, through the unions, we were able to get the safe needle laws. We've been able to fight to hopefully get this Medicaid expansion passed in Pennsylvania. And it's just going to make it more difficult, and it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to take away the voice of people that have direct care to the most vulnerable citizens of this state. I mean, these people have worked their entire lives. You know, they end up coming to our facility. Their last year should be with dignity, or if they're there for therapy, it should be a happy, you know, pleasant experience. And through being able to us go out and, you know, advocate for them, we can make those conditions better.
Yeah,
I
agree with
you. It's important.
I think it's extremely important. I think it's important that the person closest to the task have the ability to have some say in how things are done. But, you know, this isn't, you know, I got to be honest. You know, you look at this scenario, and I don't know that they really care about people in nursing homes. I don't think they really care about teachers and kids in classrooms. I think this is purely an ideological fight that they think is going to get them and consolidate in their hands more power. That simple. There's no good reason for it. They throw out, oh, it's costly. There's no cost to it. They throw out that,
yeah,
oh, we're collecting dues money to spend on politics, which dues money can't be used for politics.
Right.
There's so much disinformation, so many lies, that you got to wonder, how is it that these people are anyone that someone would respect?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me. Basically, I look at it as, you know, that we defeated them with the voter ID law. That was one way they were going to try to, you know, push themselves into office.
Yep.
By blocking, you know, thousands and thousands of people from being able to vote. So we got that blocked, and now they're going to be like, well, we can't go that route, so let's just weaken the, you know, the voice of the union, and we'll push ourselves in that way. And I mean, I don't understand it. It doesn't even make sense. I mean, you know, they're coming after nurses and teachers, yet firefighters and police are excluded, you know.
For today.
And, you know, they were with us at the Capitol, side by side with us, showing support, saying, you know, we don't care. We're not part of this. We have your back, and this is an attack against all of us, you know, and it is. I mean, it's an attack against all workers, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
You know, 3 years ago, we were in Wisconsin for the uprising there. Scott Walker did away with collective bargaining rights for public employees. And I remember saying, look, Pennsylvania, we're here in Wisconsin at the time, sleeping on the floor of the Capitol, on the cold marble floor, saying this is going to come our way. You know, I've heard, you know, the Cutlers and the Eichelbergers of the world saying, well, you know, this is what our constituents want us to do. Yet this seems to be, to me, part of a national strategy, a playbook that 3 years ago I was saying it's going to be passed around. And it looks like the playbook is here in Pennsylvania. And I've been trying to find out who the constituents are who really want this, and how big of a problem this is if they're spending all of this time, all of this energy, and all of our tax dollars.
Right.
Pursuing. I mean, I got to wonder, how much of our money have they spent pushing this? And how much, if let's say they get it, they pass this law through, and we no longer allowed to have dues collected, how much did we save from not collecting the dues compared to how much we spent going after them?
Not even a comparison, I'm sure.
And, you know,
you know.
At some point, you've just got to point the finger and go, hey, this is what it is. This is the Koch brothers. This is the billionaire class of this country saying, we want what we want, and you go do it now.
Right.
So Tuesday you were in the streets here in Harrisburg. Today and Cranberry. Where are you going tomorrow?
Well, I continue on working. I'm actually working on my campaign right now, you know, centered around Pittsburgh. And but I will tell you that if this isn't going away, I mean, they said that Tuesday's event in the Capitol was the largest that they've ever seen. And if this keeps getting pushed, we'll be back. I'll be back, along with the thousands of people that were there. And it'll just grow each time. And it's not going to go away. Like, we're not going to let this happen, you know, and be quiet. So, you know, we're obviously urging everybody to call their legislator and tell them to not support this. You know, it's a bad move. It's a bad move for our state, and it's a bad move for all working people. And we're not gonna let this just go through and be quiet about it.
Yeah, so. I think they've awakened a sleeping giant, because the reality is when someone like you, who's working 40 hours a week, busting your behind to take care of our most vulnerable, when you're taking days to go to Harrisburg from the west end of the state, when you're taking days to go out to have your say, to me that's a power I don't think they really wanted to open up.
No, and it's just gonna get bigger. I mean, Tuesday was amazing. I mean, it was one of the energy in that building was just, I mean, I don't even have words to describe what it felt like to be in that building. I got to speak in front of everyone and never thought I'd do that. And, you know, I would do it again in a heartbeat if I have to.
Okay.
So, and I'm not alone. I mean, there were, I think they said roughly about 2,000 people, you know, either inside or out, and we'll be back.
And
we're going to continue to go to the offices and try to find them in their office if they're not hiding from us.
They're not. If that's the key, if they're not hiding from us.
If they're not hiding.
But good on you, Rita. I appreciate you taking time for us and telling us about you. It was great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You know, I look at this, and you know, the reality is quite simply, this is exactly as Rita pointed out. This is just an attack on people like her, an attack on working people. But you know, when I was in the Capitol on Tuesday, when I was talking to folks who were fortunate enough to get inside, and some of the people that I got to talk to outside, they felt empowered. And they felt that they were under attack. You know, and some of them actually, and this was kind of in a way sad, comical, however you want to use it, a couple of them had admitted to voting for Corbett. Some of them were Republicans saying, I can't believe, you know, couldn't believe they're coming for us. I think the calculus, because I remember being in Wisconsin 3 years ago, and I remember talking to people when I got back saying, hey, we really need to be thinking about how are you going to stymie these attacks when they get here? Because they went through Ohio, they went through Michigan, they went through Indiana, they went through Tennessee, they went through Florida. They've gone through all of these states across the country. The playbook's been passed around. And I was saying, what are you going to do? And they all tell me, well, no, Pennsylvania, too moderate. We won't go for that insanity. Well, I think now is the time to be thinking about that moderation. And those people who I met at the Capitol, union members who were registered Republicans, and they had their reasons, who never thought in a million years that their party would turn on their right to be a member of a labor union, are starting to rethink their affiliation. And I think more importantly, looking at getting more involved and taking their party back. And I think that's a part of this as well. A part of it as well is right now, Republicans, look at what your party's doing. Because if you remember the very first argument in this, it was about the money. We're saving money for the taxpayer. And then when you realized that the amount of money it cost was nil, then that message changed. Well, we're just getting government out of the business of collecting stuff. How about United Way or car loans or any of that stuff? You know, Christmas clubs or any of that stuff. Well, that's different. How's it different? It's the same line. And the excuses keep changing. The best one I heard was, we're going to make unions work better. I'm going, really? The guy who wants to destroy it is actually concerned that they work better? I'm confused at that. Explain that to me. No explanation there, but a talking point nonetheless. Now, I go back to the people I met at that at the rally. A couple of words kept coming up. Empowerment. The sense that, you know what, they're not alone. This idea that this is our community. These are our people. We are in this together. We are one. And this is what democracy looks like. People taking to their capital. And I got to be honest, you know, when I first heard they were doing this, you know, the labor movement in the state was going to have a press conference, every, well, you know, 50, 100 people show up. Because if you've ever been to any of the press conferences at the Capitol, you know, there's, you know, 10, 15 people. Because, you know, on a Tuesday at 10 o'clock in the morning, people have to work. You got some 2,000, 3,000 people who took the day off from work, traveled all the way to the state capitol to say, no, not going to happen. Not on my watch. Think about that for a second. I mean, that's pretty powerful stuff. And it's got to be a wake-up call. It's absolutely got to be a wake-up call for Republicans who, you know, didn't think anyone would notice, didn't think anyone would be paying attention, that they could sneak this through. And I've heard that happen that a couple of times. Well, you know, they thought that they would pull a fast one. There's no fast one. People are now paying attention. They've awakened people. And I had the opportunity to talk to probably 100 people while I was at the Capitol during this event. And they all, almost to the letter, said, you know, I would have never thought. They all said, you know, I know their disagreements and I know their, but I never thought that they were going to really come after us like, and do this to us, their constituents. Which takes me back to, it's not about the constituents. It's about the people who are funding their campaigns. It's about the money in our politic. It's about the corrosive, poisonous effect of our lax campaign laws. When, and this is, you know, this is what I've heard. I can't vouch for its validity, but it makes sense. When you hear that the wealthy in this country, the big donors have come and said to Republican legislators, you vote for this, and we'll double, even triple the amount of money labor gives you. And if you don't, we're going to spend huge money against you. I mean, at some point, doesn't it kind of make sense? Just a thought. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. It's desperate times, so desperate measures we explore. Marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out. Where's our Democrats? Lawsuits and arraignments. Members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Profit billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have spoken to a gap. But we never give up. We'll be here one day longer.
Radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
I'm Doug Cunningham.
President Obama could have done much more for working people in his State of the Union speech. AFL-CIO Chief Economist William Spriggs, speaking on Washington, D.C.'s We Act Radio, says if Obama is serious about addressing income inequality, he has to be serious about reversing decades of policies that helped create it.
It was a little disappointing because the president said, look, we didn't get into this situation yesterday or even with the Great Recession for 30 years before then. We had rising inequality, but then he blamed it on technology and global competition. Now, global competition, yes, but he could have mentioned bad trade deals. Mm-hmm. It's really policy that got us in this situation, and that was the moment to say, so we have to reverse the policies.
Spriggs says Obama should not be shy about asserting government's role of advocating for working people.
Government needs to be on the side of the people. This needs to be government for the people. One of the things is that government can be for you having higher wages. And we have to back away from thinking government can't be for the people. I mean, he's doing an executive order on the minimum wage. He could have done an executive order talking about employers following the National Labor Relations Act. He could have talked about more good things that employers should do if they're going to be government contractors. So there was a lot more room for him to talk about those institutions and those things that matter, like unions.
We Are One Illinois is suing the state over pension cuts for public workers, alleging the cuts to cost of living increases and raising retirement ages is unconstitutional. We Are One Illinois includes the state AFL-CIO, AFSCME, SEIU, Illinois Federation of Teachers, and the Illinois Education Association. Workers held up their end of the pensions bargain by putting in the labor and in some cases foregoing wage increases to maintain a good pension system for decades. Politicians, though, shortchanged the workers for decades by not properly funding the pension system. So Illinois is facing a $100 billion 30-year unfunded pension liability. The state's solution was to renege on the pension promise and to cut the benefits. The state constitution prohibits diminishing, though, of public worker pensions. Illinois AFL-CIO President Michael Kerrigan says the state is engaging in pension theft that is not only unfair but unconstitutional. In a letter to Congress, Christian leaders are joining the call to extend unemployment benefits. The group includes the National Council of Churches. Jim Winkler is council president. He says scripture repeatedly calls for national leaders to care for those in need, and this is a moment for our nation's leaders to choose to provide assistance to the jobless.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light, hey, stand up for your rights. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Well, you know, that's what they were doing on Tuesday. Thousands of them came to the state capitol to say, you know what, we're not going to put up with the poison, not going to put up with 1507 or 1034. And what did the Capitol Police do? Well, held half of them out. Left them out freezing in the cold. And I guess that is about par for what the governor and this administration has done for working people over the last 3.5 years. And if he's reelected, heaven forbid, it will be 4 more years of more of the same. And you look, you know, I look at this whole talk of reforming the pension system, a crisis that was created, I would argue, by the people running our government with the intention of destroying it. And I've heard this nasty rumor a little earlier. We were talking with Ted Kirsch, president of AFT Pennsylvania, who said that there may be an increase in education spending. And the rumor is they're going to steal it from the contributions that they should be making to the pension system, which would make the problem with pensions that much worse, which would give them a reason to go and want to destroy it even faster. So it's a twofer, I guess, in their worldview. In my view, it's theft, which is why we've asked our good friend Dr. Steven Herzenberg, executive director of the Keystone Research Center, to come talk to us about the pension situation here in Pennsylvania. Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here, Rick.
So I've heard this rumor, and maybe you can either confirm it or tell me I'm wrong, but I've heard that there might be some education money coming in the next budget, and the idea is they're just not going to make contributions to the teachers' pensions.
I mean, no one knows exactly what's coming down the line from the governor in his budget address on Tuesday, but, yeah, there are rumors along the lines of what you just said, which is keep talking about the pension issue, which really is a result of not making contributions that should have been made over the last 10 years when they were making cuts in corporate taxes that we couldn't afford and, you know, weren't putting the money they needed to put into the pension system. And so, yeah, I mean, there is an issue with pensions, you know, they're trying to play off pension funding against education funding. So, you know, the outlines of what's expected are, yeah, they'll come back to the idea that, yes, we can put more money into funding education, funding our schools, but only if we put less money into pensions, which, like you say, will make that problem worse. So we're expecting something along those lines.
Let me me ask you this. You know, I hear a lot of talk about how we reform the system because we've had this enormous unfunded liability, and they throw out these eye-popping numbers. Now, you're a well-educated MIT graduate, PhD economist. Is this the end of the world that they're telling us? Is this something that can be solved with some fixes around the edges? Are we did Act 120 put us on the right direction? Are defined contributions the solution? I'm curious.
No, I mean, again, the basic idea that workers who work a whole career and work hard should get a decent retirement. The one place where that basic idea is still honored is the public sector. And, you know, that's what's under assault. And, no, I mean, can we afford middle-class pensions, you know, $24,000 a person on average for Pennsylvania public sector workers? Can we afford pensions like that? Yes, we can. And so, I mean, to some extent, this is an issue of we need to hold on to decent pensions for hardworking folks where we still have them in the public sector so that we can use that foundation to sort of fight for better retirement, better pensions in the private sector where, to a large extent, you know, pensions have gone away. So, I mean, we need to hold the line, not let, the legislature, not let Governor Corbett destroy decent pensions for middle-class folks, the one place where they still exist.
I remember the hearings that they had on this last summer, I think it was, and one of the state senators threw out a question to you that I thought was probably the dumbest question that could have been asked, and a nice softball. I don't know if you paid him for it, but he said that, you know, why has the private sector walked away from defined benefit pension plans while the state government hasn't? I'm curious that answer because, you know, I loved it.
Right. Well, I remember being asked that question, and that's right. It was along the lines of if defined benefit pensions are so great, how come the private sector has abandoned them? And it's like a question that answers itself. Well, because when you're not required to put in a decent amount of money and guarantee people some kind of middle class retirement, then you, the private sector companies, don't have to put anything in. So you get to walk away scot-free. So, yeah, so that was not a tough question. You're right, it was a softball, even though I'm not sure he realized it was a softball. So, again, that's back to the basic issue, which is retirement security has been mostly abandoned in the private sector. Again, we're living on, a lot of older workers, a lot of current retired workers who worked in the private sector are still living off the strength of the middle class and unions back in the New Deal era.
Right.
So that if you're 80 today and you retired at 60 in whatever 1993, and you started working in the late 1950s, you know, again, lots of folks like that still have pensions. And so, I mean, we haven't hit the bottom yet in terms of 10, 15 years from now, you're talking about people who didn't start working, you know, until 1990 or something like that, or 1985.
You're talking about me.
Well, okay, yeah. And then you're actually talking about me, too. I mean, I worked for 6 or 7 years in the federal government. And actually, my wife has worked for like 7 years in the Pennsylvania state government. So in some ways, we're lucky again, because Social Security still provides a foundation, and if you have some number of years with a defined benefit pension like Sarah and I do, then you piece that together with Social Security and a little bit of savings, and, you know, you can have a decent retirement.
That was the plan.
Yeah, that's the whole plan. It's exactly right. It's the whole three-legged stool, Social Security, a pension, and your savings, and that's exactly what we will be lucky enough to piece together. But the problem is if you go 10, 15 years down the road, most folks, unlike Sarah and I, didn't work for 7 or 8 years in the public sector. Many folks don't have any savings or more than a nominal amount in savings. You know, Social Security, thankfully, is still there.
Even though they're talking about cutting some of it.
Yeah. So again, it's the basic bottom line is the battle coming up starting Tuesday with the governor's budget address. It's another year of trying to hold the line in terms of restructuring Pennsylvania's pensions for public sector workers, you know, holding off an attempt to abandon the idea that people who work for a whole career in public service, sacrificing on the salary side, get a decent pension. So let's see if we can hold the line for another year and, you know, and then see if in a different set of political circumstances, instead of just holding the line on protecting public sector pensions, maybe we can do something for the private sector workers that don't have anything. You know, it is, again, I've partly growing out of the work we've done on Pennsylvania public sector pensions, we've done work on a number of other states, because other states like Florida and Oklahoma and Arizona and Illinois are all facing similar kinds of pension battles. And so in the course of doing that work, you know, partly one of the things we've looked at is taking a hard look at public sector pensions, how much of those, because there are all these stories about outsized pensions, right? Arizona has had a bunch of press stories on this, like conveying the idea that, you know, there are these a lot of public sector workers with these fat pensions of over $100,000. And then then you look at the numbers, and it's complete nonsense.
Right.
You know, I mean, the average, again, our pensions are $24,000. Arizona, the average pension is $22,000. You know, we did some calculations, and, like, I don't remember the exact numbers, but the tiny number of people who earn over 100,000. But then when you look at where the money goes for public sector pensions, you know, a few folks, you know, a few judges, maybe a few high-end civil servants get, you know, over 100,000. But when you compare that, you look at 401k accounts, you look at the private sector, you know, best practice, right? This is supposed to be the model for retirement security for the future. And you look at where the money is in the private sector, and it's just stunning. You know, I mean, the typical 401k account has $15,000, $20,000. And then you've got this tiny number of accounts that have over $500,000.
Right.
So it's what it is, it's the 1% economy, again, where all the money flows to the top, but it's the 1% economy comes to the retirement, comes to retired folks, comes to seniors, and again, you do the pie chart, which show, you know, out of every, out of the total pot of retirement income, how much goes to the top 1%, and when it comes to 401ks, enormous amounts go to the very top end. When it comes to typical pensions, the folks at the bottom are getting 20%, a third as much as the folks at the top. I mean, there's still some inequality, but traditional pensions, which key that pension to, what people made when they were working, the folks at the bottom, the janitor, the school custodian, the office worker, they still get enough to live on when you combine it with Social Security. When it comes to the 401k approach to retirement, the folks on the bottom are left with nothing, just with the Social Security.
Yeah, I mean, so I look at this and I go, you know, the message has been, well, those public sector workers have these pensions, these gilded pensions, because, hey, if you don't have anything, if there's nothing there for you, $24,000 seems like an awful lot. In my view, it's instead of asking, you know, why they have them and I don't, how do I get them? And I guess, you know, the other night during the State of the Union, the president brought up this idea of my RA. Which is, I guess, we're going to start doing IRAs for people. I'm of the mindset, if you're going to do that, why not just expand Social Security and make that a bigger portion of folks' retirement?
Well, again, so I think both of those things are a step in the right direction. I mean, again, the basic idea that the government should at least make it easier for people over and above Social Security as it stands to save something for retirement, the basic idea that, people should automatically put in 3% or 5% of the salary, and if, you know, maybe if they don't want to, they can exempt. thumb is that you put money in, because right now the normal rule of thumb, even where private companies have a 401k, is unless you elect to put money in, you put nothing in.
Right.
So, I mean, I think what the president proposed, which comes out of debates that have existed at the state level for a dozen years, you know, is a step in a better direction. Now, yeah, would augmenting Social Security, having state supplements to Social Security, be an even better approach? That's a fair point. But again, shifting the conversation from, you know, oh my goodness, look, we didn't put any money into pensions during the worst financial market decade in 75 years, and what a surprise, the pensions are underfunded. Let's, you know, they're unsustainable, right? I mean, turning the debate from let's destroy the middle class pensions public sector workers have to a conversation about what's the right approach to restore a decent retirement for folks in the private sector. That's the shift in the debate we need to happen. And I think what Obama said was helpful. Again, in Pennsylvania, we ain't turning that corner until at least 2015. Hopefully in 2015, you know, we can get back to the real retirement security crisis, which is not the false claim that we can't afford public sector pensions. The real retirement security crisis is the fact that too many people in the private sector who work hard and play by the rules don't have any pensions at the end of the day.
Last question I've got for you, you know, in looking at that, what are the expectations Tuesday? Are we going to see another year of not contributing to the pensions and only exacerbating the problem?
You know, I think there's going to be a battle over it. I mean, to me, this is just a grotesque bait and switch, right? We've had, you know, over a year now of, oh, look at this unfunded liability. Look at this unfunded liability. Look at all this debt we've got, billions of dollars owed to the pension system. And then you come forward with a proposal that puts less money into pensions, right? which is just preposterous. And so I think we're going to get more of the same, another bait and switch. Look at this problem. And then here's a solution that actually makes the problem worse. Folks like you and we are going to try to have to educate the public, you know, educate lawmakers that putting less money into pensions, kicking the can down the road, manufacturing more of a crisis for pensions by not putting money into them, you know, is not the way to go. The only good news, I think, is that the overall revenue picture, two pieces of good news. The overall revenue picture is a little bit better than it was, despite, you know, Governor Corbett's best efforts. The overall national economy is recovering, and Pennsylvania is benefiting some from that. So income taxes, corporate taxes, despite the cut, sales taxes, you know, revenue is going back up, which makes our budget choices a little bit easier. And then the other thing is, I do think we've made progress in terms of educating the public and the legislature around how much the corporate tax cuts have hemorrhaged the state budget, and how, so we had some delays in the phase out of one big corporate tax last year. I think with the overall economy recovering and with a bit more of an honest debate around why are we doing these corporate tax cuts for these massively profitable corporations when there's no evidence that the corporate tax cut, you know, does anything for jobs and does anything for the state's economy? I think those two things give us a shot at a budget that, is a little more sensible, and also give us a shot at, holding the line one more time. Let's put the money into the pensions that the 2010 reform, Act 120, the Pension Reform Act of 2010. Let's stay with that plan for one more year, and then in a more sane political climate, you know, if we want to revisit the pension issue, maybe we can do it. But I think this year it has to be a question of holding the line.
Yeah, I'm with you. Steve, appreciate the time. Always great talk with you. Always insightful. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Dr. Steven Hertzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, keystoneresearch.org, the website. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together. The Rick Smith Show.
A corporate lobbyist recently admitted to the New York Times, everybody is embarrassed about it, although not so embarrassed that they don't do it. It is the scandalous copulation between corporate cash and willing legislators that's taking place regularly in such secretive rendezvous resorts as the Dorado Beach Ritz-Carlton. Lawmakers and lobbyists don't like to talk about what they're doing and certainly don't want voters or the media to see them, for these getaways are explicit, tawdry examples of the prostitution of our legislative system. If you had wandered innocently into the Tony Four Seasons Hotel of Vail, Colorado in early January, you could have witnessed one of these group gropes. Assorted lobbyists, including one who represents the utility giant, PPL Corporation, had slipped tens of thousands of dollars into the political pockets of Representative Ed Whitfield and four other House members for the pleasure of rubbing elbows, wining and dining, and whispering sweet legislative nothings to them for hours. At one dinner, the cozy group dug into juicy Wagyu steaks and swilled $60-a-bottle wine as they played scratch-my-back Washington-style politics. Whitfield, a Kentucky Republican, was especially popular with a utility lobbyist, for he chairs the House committee that handles legislation affecting, guess who, utilities. And Ed must have had a good time in Vail, because when he returned to Washington, he promptly introduced a bill to let PPL and other electric utilities build additional polluting, coal-burning power plants, an industry favor that would overturn health protections recently approved by the Obama administration. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, the public approval rating for Congress is at historic lows, but the veiled experience of Whitfield and the others just shows that lawmakers can be lovable. You just have to know the price. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or download the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And, you know, I want to go back over that for a second because, you know, you look at what Steve was talking about. Understand, the pension situation that we're in is pretty simple. And it comes down to if we have to use kitchen table economics, which they love to simplify. They love to oversimplify things. If you don't put enough money away, if you don't take care of a problem immediately, if you don't keep up with it, it's going to get worse. Now, understand, during the Ridge years, it's going back into the 90s. Things were good. Wall Street was, you know, hammering out good returns. The actuaries had, you know, figured, wow, our pensions are flush with cash. So they figured, well, hey, it's party time. And this is not just Pennsylvania. This is across the country. It was party time. It was time for the CEO class. It was time for the corporate boardrooms to go, you know what? Hey, we've been giving you too much tax money. We need tax breaks. Times are so good. So they didn't put money into the pensions because, you know, the numbers said, hey, we're fully funded. and they stopped putting money into it. For about a decade. For about a decade. They said, well, no, but you know who put money into their pension fund religiously? Week after week after week after week? The people who, that's right, the people who need the pension. The people who contractually were obligated to every week put money into it. And they upheld their end of their contractual agreement. Now, the person who didn't uphold their end of the contractual agreement would be our state legislature and the governors, who said, well, you know, pension funds flush with cash. Let's spend it on other things. And then the Bush collapse happened. Then all of the bad corporate policy, thanks to Bill Clinton, thanks to George W. Bush, thanks to our corporate class, all of the bad ideas, all of the poison, all of the kabuki theater, all of the shenanigans all came to a head. All of the con games, all of the Ponzi schemes, all of the graft all came to a head. And bang. The nation to its knees. Ben Bernanke coming out saying, we're going to do anything we have to do to save Wall Street. I wish we would have that kind of commitment to Main Street. So the pensions took this huge hit. Now remember, for at least a decade, before that, they had stopped making contributions. So one could make the argument, well, it was a good thing and they'd have lost half their money. But there would have still been the other half there, which would have made the losses less, which would have made the recovery a little better because you would have had more shares and all of that stuff that, that long-term investors like to preach about. But we didn't do it. And now what they want to do is they want to go back and say, well, we didn't do that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now we want to cut the contract. We want to change the contract midstream. And I've always loved that idea that for them, it's always okay to break a contract, but for you or me, good luck. If for them, it's always okay to go back on their agreement. Be it through, you know, because understand, these are the people who keep telling us that government can run like a corporation. And what we're seeing right before our eyes is no different than what they were doing to Bethlehem Steel. They're sucking it dry of all of its assets. Sucking it dry, they're underfunding it, not investing in it, creating this huge liability, and then they go before the bankruptcy court and say, well, you know, I'm sorry, we can't pay it. And with a stroke of a pen, all the working people who worked for that company for generations, they lost. They lost huge amounts of wealth. And in that stroke of a pen, you think of the wealth transfer from the shareholder class to from the working class to the shareholder class. And you see what's going on here today. You've got legislators, you've got politicians, you've got those folks who are making, pulling the strings, making the decisions, doing the exact same thing. Only the difference is on the state government level, they actually have some rights and some laws on their side. So they've got to make the problem worse, which is why, you know, when I heard that Corbett was not going to make the contribution this year fully to the pension fund, it made me stop in my tracks. Because, again, it's about making the problem that much worse. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Brother firefighters, my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is the union town, a union town, all down the line. This is the union town, a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, a union town, all down the line.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. President Obama could have done much more for working people in his State of the Union speech. AFL-CIO Chief Economist William Spriggs, speaking on Washington, D.C.'s We Act Radio, says if Obama is serious about addressing income inequality, he has to be serious about reversing decades of policies that helped create it.
It was a little disappointing because the president said, look, we didn't get into this situation yesterday or even with the Great Recession. For 30 years before then, we had rising inequality. But then he blamed it on technology and global competition. Now, global competition, yes, but he could have mentioned bad trade deals. Mm-hmm. It's really policy that got us in this situation. And that was the moment to say, so we have to reverse the policies.
Spriggs says Obama should not be shy about asserting government's role of advocating for working people.
Government needs to be on the side of the people. This needs to be government for the people. One of the things is that government can be for you having higher wages. And we have to back away from thinking government can't be for the people. I mean, he's doing an executive order on the minimum wage. He could have done an executive order talking about employers following the National Labor Relations Act. He could have talked about more good things that employers should do if they're going to be government contractors. So there was a lot more room for him to talk about those institutions and those things that matter, like unions.
We Are One Illinois is suing the state over pension cuts for public workers, alleging the cuts to cost of living increases and raising retirement ages is unconstitutional. We Are One Illinois includes the state AFL-CIO, AFSCME, SEIU, Illinois Federation of Teachers, and the Illinois Education Association. Workers held up their end of the pensions bargain by putting in the labor and in some cases forgoing wage increases to maintain a good pension system for decades. Politicians, though, shortchanged the workers for decades by not properly funding the pension system. So Illinois is facing a $100 billion 30-year unfunded pension liability. The state's solution was to renege on the pension promise and to cut the benefits. The state constitution prohibits diminishing, though, of public worker pensions. Illinois AFL-CIO President Michael Kerrigan says the state is engaging in pension theft that is not only unfair but unconstitutional. In a letter to Congress, Christian leaders are joining the call to extend unemployment benefits. The group includes the National Council of Churches. Jim Winkler is council president. He says Scripture repeatedly calls for national leaders to care for those in need, and this is a moment for our nation's leaders to choose to provide assistance to the jobless.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
One of the objectives we have over the next couple months is to help folks understand some of the circumstances that lead folks to a life of poverty. It could just be one bad decision or one unfortunate circumstance that spirals to a life of poverty. And we hope to examine what those decisions are, what barriers are keeping folks in poverty, and helping to eliminate some of those barriers in the future for individuals and families across the state.
I got to be honest with you. Every time I hear that, every time I hear that clip, one bad decision, one bad choice, like being born, I guess. I mean, isn't that what you're saying? I mean, most of the people who are in poverty today, they were born into it. We have a system that keeps people in generational poverty. And to me, you know, at the end of it, it comes down to jobs. And one of the things that Chairman Reid didn't do over the summer as he was going across the Commonwealth, he didn't focus on getting people back to work. I didn't see any jobs plans, even though they said, jobs, we're going after the jobs. Everything that you could figure out that would be divisive and destructive, that's what they went after. And for me, how you break poverty, get people employed. Get them an opportunity to make a decent wage and a livable wage. And in my view, a union wage as well. Now, the president during his State of the Union address said he was going to use the phone and the pen, talking about issuing an executive order that would raise the wages of workers on federal contracts. You know, the people at the Smithsonian who serve food, the people at the Pentagon who serve food, who do janitorial work, saying, you know what, we're going to use the power of the pen to make those folks lives that much better. But the question that I had is, what about anybody can be excluded from this? What about folks with disabilities? And I saw this report today that said possibly folks with disabilities were going to be left out of this, which is why I've asked Samantha Crane. She's the director of public policy with the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. AutisticAdvocacy.org is their website. Samantha, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on.
I saw this executive order, and I was under the impression, and correct me if I am wrong, that this meant anybody working on federal contracts. I can't imagine anybody would be excluded from it, right?
Well, there shouldn't be, and at this point, the executive order, we haven't seen the full text of it, so there is a possibility that in the final version, they will make the right decision and make sure that everyone is included. But we've heard that at this point, the administration plans to have this executive order apply in kind of not at least not in full to people with disabilities who are currently earning less than minimum wage.
And what sense would that make? I mean, to me, it wouldn't make any sense to me. You know, it doesn't matter to me. If someone's doing the job, they should be able to make a decent living at it.
Well, I mean, exactly. If someone has a disability, that doesn't necessarily mean, in fact, it absolutely does not mean that they can somehow live on $2 an hour. But there is an exception to the minimum wage law that's from the 1930s that allows employers with certain kinds of certificates to pay people with disabilities at a fraction of the federal minimum wage. And this certificate, the original justification of this program was the assumption that people with disabilities were simply not as good workers as people who don't have disabilities. But we're finding that that's not actually true. And at the very least, people with disabilities need to live and need a decent wage to live just as much as anyone else does.
Right. And at the end of the day, I'm in favor of this idea that your work, what you do for a living, what you do to put food on the table should be enough to be able to do some basic bare minimum things like put a roof over your head, food on the table, maybe a couple of nice things here and there, and not be subsidized and supported by tax dollars. And what you're laying out is if we're going to allow a subsection of the workforce to be exploited and paid less than a living wage, then that's going to be supported by tax dollars. And that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. I think employment has dignity. I think it's something that we should be encouraging. But this idea that we're going to prop up a subsidized workforce doesn't seem all that right to me.
Right. And I mean, in reality, it's people with disabilities who might need specific disability-related services might always be using some kind of government program. But they shouldn't need a government program if they're working 40 hours a week. They shouldn't also need a subsidy in order to simply eat and put a roof over their head.
Right. Now, I've been challenged on this. I've been challenged on this view in the past because we've had other disability advocacy groups on the program, and there are some folks who say that the only way employers will hire folks with disabilities is if there's a sweetener. And I'm curious what your thought on that is.
Well, we find that this tends not to be the case, and in fact, in the context of federal contracting, and it's important to remember that this executive order only applies to people who work for federal contractors. There are actually quite a few programs to encourage federal contractors to hire more people with disabilities. In fact, the Department of Labor has issued guidance requiring federal contractors to set hiring targets for people with disabilities and to conduct really affirmative outreach activities to make sure that people with disabilities are included in the federal contract workforce. So it's absolutely not the case that people with disabilities won't be hired by federal contractors if they can't if they have to pay people with disabilities the same ways that they pay everyone else.
Let me ask you this, Samantha Crenn. You know, and having had more than a decade of war and seeing a lot of our heroes coming back wounded and maimed and with disabilities, you know, this kind of would apply to them, right?
Well, there's people with, it depends on whether or not they, which program they end up in. There's a bit of luck in this, but right. Yes, I mean, many people who work in these sheltered workshop environments may very well be injured veterans.
Now, your group, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, what's your line of work in this? What is your specialty?
Well, I'm the director of public policy programs for the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which means that I focus on issues of legislative and regulatory policy that affect people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And we find that people with intellectual disabilities, like Down syndrome, and people with developmental disabilities, like autism spectrum disorders, tend to be a major population that gets sent into these sub-minimum wage jobs.
And this is an opportunity to, you know, because you see the numbers, and the numbers are staggering, of folks who have some of these disabilities. And, you know, for me, I do believe there's a dignity in work, and we shouldn't be discriminating against people based on disabilities that can be overcome, correct? I mean, there are ways to make accommodations to help folks.
Well, yeah, I mean, people with disabilities frequently, and in fact, we would say always, have the ability to do decent work in a competitive, integrated environment that includes both people with disabilities and people without disabilities. And they often, you can often find ways to use adaptive technology or to focus on people's skills and interests to make sure that they can find a job that really fits them, in which they can really contribute something of value and feel proud of that.
And for me, the federal contracting should be one of those areas, at the barest of minimums, where we raise the standards a little bit. So what can we do? I know the executive order isn't dry yet. I know there's probably a lot of questions still. What can we do to make sure that there aren't sections of folks who are all left out?
Well, I know that there is some talk in Congress of eliminating this program, what's called the 14C program, which allows people with disabilities to be paid less than minimum wage. And so people should definitely write to their congressman saying that they oppose the continuation of the program that allows employers to pay less than minimum wage to people with disabilities. We should also just keep people writing into the White House and telling the White House that it's a big priority of them to make of theirs to make sure that people when we're talking about income inequality, that income inequality applies to people with disabilities as well. People with disabilities shouldn't be earning less than people without disabilities simply because of their disability.
You know, I look at this, and you know, as you laid out there, this is from the 1930s. And I would have to think that the view of people with disabilities from the 1930s, or I would hope, I probably shouldn't say I think, I should probably say I hope that the view of folks with disabilities from the 1930s has changed to today.
Well, unfortunately, I mean, I think that is definitely true among disability advocates and also among many people who work with disabilities and run programs that work with people with disabilities. But you unfortunately still see people openly advocating paying less than sub-minimum wage to people with disabilities.
And again, this is another, for me, another opportunity to go back and to redo our federal labor law and to make sure that, we have an opportunity to change things.
Yeah, and it's an opportunity to educate people that it's simply not the case that people with disabilities can't do real work, real valuable work that justifies paying people the same exact wage.
No, and I think there's dignity in all work and for all people, and this to me seems to just to be a no-brainer. Samantha Crane, I appreciate you taking time for us and filling us in on this. We will make sure that we follow up. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks so much. Samantha Crane, Director of Public Policy at the Autistic Self Advocacy Network. Of course, the website, autisticadvocacy.org, if you want more information. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Corporate lobbyists recently admitted to the New York Times, everybody is embarrassed about it, although not so embarrassed that they don't do it. It is the scandalous copulation between corporate cash and willing legislators that's taking place regularly in such secretive rendezvous resorts as the Dorado Beach Ritz-Carlton. Lawmakers and lobbyists don't like to talk about what they're doing and certainly don't want voters or the media to see them, for these getaways are explicit, tawdry examples of the prostitution of our legislative system. If you had wandered innocently into the Tony Four Seasons Hotel of Vail, Colorado in early January, you could have witnessed one of these group gropes. Assorted lobbyists, including one who represents the utility giant, PPL Corporation, had slipped tens of thousands of dollars into the political pockets of Representative Ed Whitfield and four other House members for the pleasure of rubbing elbows, wining and dining, and whispering sweet legislative nothings to them for hours. At one dinner, the cozy group dug into juicy Wagyu steaks and swilled $60 a bottle wine as they played scratch-my-back Washington-style politics. Whitfield, a Kentucky Republican, was especially popular with the utility lobbyists, for he chairs the House committee that handles legislation affecting, guess who, utilities. And Ed must have had a good time in Vail, because when he returned to Washington, he promptly introduced a bill to let PPL and other electric utilities build additional polluting, coal-burning power plants, an industry favor that would overturn health protections recently approved by the Obama administration. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, the public approval rating for Congress is at historic lows, but the veiled experience of Whitfield and the others just shows that lawmakers can be lovable. You just have to know the price.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been discussing how a 1964 championship boxing match had a major impact on American politics and culture. Cassius Clay had stunned the sports world with a pre-fight show of dancing, poetry, and taunting. But when he pulled off one of the biggest upsets in boxing history with a win in the seventh round over Sonny Liston, he made the world notice. As the technology of television broadcast his image and sound, he did shock the world. He jumped in the air and delivered a rant that will never be forgotten. I'm the greatest fighter that ever lived. I talked to God every day. I shook up the world. I am the king of the world. I am pretty. I'm a bad man. Our politics would never be the same. Shortly after the fight, Clay announced he was changing his name to Muhammad Ali and joining the Nation of Islam. Join us again for his impact. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. So the big news today that pretty much just took over the Internet, I guess, all day was the announcement that the, I can't pronounce his name, the guy that they shot up, brought back to health so that he could stand trial, and now they're going to kill him. That's the idea. He will possibly face the death penalty. If convicted of first degree, murder there and the deadly assaults that happened, at the Boston Marathon, which Eric Holder announced today. Now me, I gotta be honest, I'm not a death penalty advocate. And I know there are some who say, oh, let's fry him, let's string him up. He's a horrible human being. And I agree. But I don't agree with state-sponsored murder. And that, again, you know, my pro-life friends, you know, you've got to at least be true to your title. As horrible and as heinous as this is, I am not in favor of state-sponsored murder. Now. This has gotten me into some weird situations. This idea that I'm not pro-killing people, as a matter of society, as a matter of our government, as a matter of institution. This has gotten me into some weird situations with people who think I'm a pacifist. I am furthest from a pacifist. And I remember it like it was yesterday. It was during the middle of the Iraq war. I had gone to the bank and I was doing my banking and someone had heard, about the show and who I was and met me in the parking lot. And it was one of those moments that was kind of awkward because, I'm not a small human being. I'm about 6'3", and I'm going, somewhere in the neighborhood of three bills. I'm not a little shrinking violet. And here's this guy about 5'6", 5'7", maybe 100 and a half, poking me in the chest, telling me that, I'm a wimp and all of this stuff. And I looked at him and I said, I don't think you quite understand. I will beat you within an inch of your life, and no one will hear your screams, and by the time someone does, it will be long, long too late. And as soon as he heard me say that, it was like, I had this wrong idea. But you're a pacifist. No. I grew up in a housing project. I got beat up every day. I fought every day. Now, fighting is in most cases, dumb. Doesn't solve anything. But I'm not against it individually. And this is where my weird position is. And I'm sure, again, I will get some email on this with some colorful language in it. I am not in favor of state-sponsored murder. That doesn't mean to say that I'm not against individuals in the moment of rage. I've often said anyone ever touched my kids, there would be nothing to stop me. But that doesn't mean that I want the state doing it. And I hope that there's an understanding of the difference. Because once the state starts doing it, now look, if I sat on a jury where some guy went after the guy who touched his kids or harmed his children or harmed his family, would I find him guilty? Probably not. And I know that's hard to believe because I'm not a pacifist. But do I believe in hanging somebody or shooting them or murdering them in some sort as a matter of state sanction? No. And my my position on it has always been, look, I've growing up where I did, understanding how the legal system works against poor people. And it's rare you ever see a rich person executed. Do you ever see a millionaire executed? You ever see somebody who has, see O.J. executed? Well, I know O.J. wasn't guilty, and he wasn't. He was found not guilty. That doesn't mean he didn't do it, but it means he was found not guilty. But let me ask you, had he been not O.J. Simpson and just Arenthral James, a guy who, you know, worked construction, or a guy who, you know, picked up trash, or, you know, guy was just an average everyday Joe or an average everyday Arenthral. Do you think he'd be sitting behind bars today, even if you believe he was not guilty, even if you buy the fact that he didn't do it? And I can't say he did or he didn't. The evidence, the way it looked to me as someone who watched the trial, pointed in his direction. But without the F. Lee Baileys, without the Johnny Cochrans, without the Barry Schecks, without the Alan Dershowitz, of which you or me or anybody else couldn't afford one of them, let alone all four of them, we would have been sitting on death row waiting for the needle, the bullet, the rope, or whatever. So here again, I look at all of these cases over the years where people have, they didn't do it. And yet they were on the track. Now this guy we know did it. And yep, we absolutely do know he did it. It's inconclusive. But I'm still against the idea. And there's the other part of me that says there's nothing worse than being locked up in a cage for the rest of your natural life. And I cannot imagine being 20 years old thinking that I'm going to be locked up in a cage for the next 50, 60 years with never an opportunity to smell the free air or see a free light or to be able to decide where I'm going to go. And I got to think that the fate much worse than death is being caged up for that entire time of the natural born life. I'd have to think that. Or at least maybe it's just me who thinks that, because, wow, you know? It's one of those things. So I'd be interested in your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm always interested, especially in that discussion, because, you know, I've had a number of people who agree and go, hey, I get it. I get the nuance of your position. I don't agree with it, but I got the nuance. And I got some people go, wow, I never thought of it in that light, especially from the pro-life position, of which we hear so much about. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Again, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, if you've got any thoughts, questions, comments. Quick break. Going to come right back here in the third hour. We're going to talk with John Micek, the editorial and opinion editor over at Penn Live, about his piece on the rally on Tuesday. And then it'll be interesting to see where he goes with a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to Win,
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
I'm Doug Cunningham. President Obama could have done much more for working people in his State of the Union speech. AFL-CIO Chief Economist William Spriggs, speaking on Washington, D.C.'s We Act Radio, says if Obama is serious about addressing income inequality, he has to be serious about reversing decades of policies that helped create it.
It was a little disappointing because the president said, look, we didn't get into this situation yesterday or even with the Great Recession. For 30 years before then, we had rising inequality. But then he blamed it on technology and global competition. Now, global competition, yes, but he could have mentioned bad trade deals. Mm-hmm. It's really policy that got us in this situation, and that was the moment to say, so we have to reverse the policies.
Spriggs says Obama should not be shy about asserting government's role of advocating for working people.
Government needs to be on the side of the people. This needs to be government for the people. One of the things is that government can be for you having higher wages. And we have to back away from thinking government can't be for the people. I mean, he's doing an executive order on the minimum wage. He could have done an executive order talking about employers following the National Labor Relations Act. He could have talked about more good things that employers should do if they're going to be government contractors. So there was a lot more room for him to talk about those institutions and those things that matter, like unions.
We Are One Illinois is suing the state over pension cuts for public workers, alleging the cuts to cost of living increases and raising retirement ages is unconstitutional. We Are One Illinois includes the state AFL-CIO, AFSCME, SEIU, Illinois Federation of Teachers, and the Illinois Education Association. Workers held up their end of the pensions bargain by putting in the labor and in some cases foregoing wage increases to maintain a good pension system for decades. Politicians, though, shortchanged the workers for decades by not properly funding the pension system. So Illinois is facing a $100 billion 30-year unfunded pension liability. The state's solution was to renege on the pension promise and to cut the benefits. The state constitution prohibits diminishing, though, of public worker pensions. Illinois AFL-CIO President Michael Kerrigan says the state is engaging in pension theft that is not only unfair but unconstitutional. In a letter to Congress, Christian leaders are joining the call to extend unemployment benefits. The group includes the National Council of Churches. Jim Winkler is council president. He says Scripture repeatedly calls for national leaders to care for those in need, and this is a moment for our nation's leaders to choose to provide assistance to the jobless.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
So this is not some isolated incident where one governor is just off on his own program. This is part of a national strategy, and they figure if they can do it in Wisconsin, they can do it in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Michigan, Ohio, and elsewhere.
Well, people gonna give you hell, take it back in 2012. Hang on, Wisconsin, hang on.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You know, that's Robert Craig. 3 years ago, just about 3 years ago right now, we had that conversation with Robert. And he said, look, you know, all of this insanity that's going on in Wisconsin, all of the push to destroy workers' rights that you're seeing in Wisconsin, you're going to see across the country. And when we went to Wisconsin, you may remember us broadcasting from inside the Capitol, sleeping on the marble floor, cold, I'll tell you. I remember saying, look, folks, you might want to start preparing. You might want to start organizing around the idea that all of this stuff is a national strategy. It's going to be on our doorstep before you know it. And I remember people saying, Rick, no. Pennsylvania is well too moderate for that, too thoughtful for that to happen. Well, here we are, some of the fringe elements of the GOP pushing this poison. But I got a number of folks who sent me John Misek's piece. He's the editor of the editorial and opinion page over at Penn Live. He sent this couple of pieces over saying, you know what, he did a good job. You had to have him come on and talk about it. So I've asked John to come talk with us. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, how are you?
I'm good. You know, I look at this, and, you know, a lot of people thought this could never happen. Not here. No, not here. We're too moderate for that.
Yeah, you know, I heard the same stuff. And you know, I'll say this. I mean, Governor Tom Corbett, to his credit, I know there's probably a lot of people in your audience who will disagree with me on this, is not cut from the same cloth as say Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin. I mean, we'll talk about the particulars of the bill in a moment. I mean, he said that he'd sign it if it reaches his desk. But more critically, though, that he hasn't said that he's going to go out and sort of actively push for this. He hasn't called on lawmakers to send him this bill.
Right. But if I could stop you there, neither did Rick Snyder in Michigan. And in fact, if you remember Rick Snyder in Michigan saying the climate in Michigan wasn't right and it wasn't something that they were going to pursue, about a couple of weeks before he actually signed it.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about the political climate for Tom Corbett right now, and this is the calculus that I'm doing. I mean, there's Franklin and Marshall poll out earlier today.
Yeah.
I mean, his re-elects are still really soft. His approvals are still really soft. To me, this is the thing that kind of like, I mean, this may go well, this may play well to the base, but the base is going to be with him anyway.
Right.
So the question is, does he want to pick a fight with, say, you know, Dave Filman at Ask Me or Rick Bloomingdale at AFL-CIO and, you know, have them come in and have the nationalists come in, spend a ton of money on them, have the national union dues, like, camping out in the rotunda like you were in Wisconsin 3 years ago. When you're going into a tough re-elect, like, I mean, why give them something like, can just like gratuitously keep yourself up with. I mean, that to me would be sort of like the biggest sort of like disincentive for the governor to get really crazy about this right now. And I mean, that's just the way I look at it.
No, I agree. I actually agree with you because, you know, I looked at this and what I'm hearing on the underneath is that you had the big moneyed interest, the Koch brothered interest here over Christmas promising huge paydays. I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't put it that way. Huge campaign coffer fills if this were to come through. And the way that some of the folks that I know are looking at this is a way to homogenize the Republican Party and go after some of the more rational voices that the Republicans still have.
Yeah, I mean that might be the case. And you know this bill that we're talking about, House Bill 1507, sponsored by Brian Cutler out of Lancaster County, and there's a companion Senate piece sponsored by John Eichelberger from Blair County. You know they say they're working alone. They claim that there's no link to the ALEC model legislation or any of this, you know, or any of the stuff that say FreedomWorks is pushing. And I have no choice but to take them on at their word.
No, you do because you're a journalist. I could throw the common sense piece together and say, this is the model legislation of ALEC.
Well,
this is.
But clearly you can connect the dots and see where this, you know, see that this is not occurring in a vacuum. I mean, that was going to be the back half of the thought.
Right.
You know, that there's, clearly there is a national movement afoot to go after organized labor. You know, the FreedomWorks memo acknowledges that organized labor in Pennsylvania is strong and the place that's kind of ripe for these so-called paycheck protection bills. So it ain't a surprise to think that, you know, the Koch brothers have been in and promising a big campaign payday if this stuff comes to pass.
Let me ask you this, because you use their vernacular, you use the paycheck protection. And in your conversations with Representative Cutler or Senator Eichelberger, have they laid out any type of protection, anything from wage theft to overtime theft to any of the real problems that I see going on? Because I look at this and look, there's no problem here. There's no here other than a very Machiavellian move to gut your enemy in public.
Well, that's what say Rick Bloomingdale from AFL-CIO will tell you, that there is no there, and this is a solution in search of a problem. And you know, we were at this news conference in the Capitol Media Center earlier in the week where the two lawmakers were talking about their bill. And it will not shock you to find out that, you know, none of that stuff you just alluded to came up in the course of the conversation. I mean, the way they're casting this is as a government reform measure. They're trying to link it to the bonus gate scandal from 5 or 6 years ago where some politicians were sent up
right.
for using taxpayer-funded staff to do political stuff.
And I'm glad they were.
Well, I mean, that's bad for the process,
yep.
and it undermines public trust. And they were guilty, and they got guilt, and from both sides,
yep.
and they were sent up for it, which is good for democracy. I'm not sure I subscribe to the argument necessarily. I mean, and this is the point that I made in the column. You know, we all have auto debits for our mortgage, for our magazine subscription, for whatever. So on one level, I can kind of see the argument here: why does government have to make these deductions? All right, so cool, great. So you talk to Rick Bloomingdale about this stuff, and he'll tell you, well, it's a negotiated thing. In the same way that they negotiate sick time or working hours or whatever, and in exchange for that, they get these concessions. And you think about, well,
All right, then. So that, you get that. And then you think, that, all right, well, the bill excludes the cops and the firefighters and excludes private unions. So who are the only ones who are getting socked here? Oh, wait, it's the unions that give to them. And then you think, well, all right, well, there it is. Boom. They want, you know, and that's where Rick's argument and Dave Feldman's argument about this just being a way to kneecap labor's fundraising capabilities, you know, sort of comes home to roost for me.
Right. But I look at this and understand, you know, I've asked a number of times, you know, how much does it cost? You know, if the cost is so great, how much does it cost? Or would it cost more money to try and figure out how much it costs?
Well, they acknowledge the cost is de minimis, if anything at all. And they say, well, that even if that's the case, again, it's about process and it's about propriety. The government shouldn't be in the business of collecting, shouldn't be in the business of making tax deductions from workers' contracts. They say it's maybe a different matter for fair share and maybe a different matter for dues. It gets a little muddy when you get the dues because sometimes that money is commingled with political money. So that's
some. Whoa, hold on, John. Who said that?
Yeah.
Because I think we both know that in this country, dues money cannot go for political purposes. Because I've seen unions, LM2s, the law is what it is. PAC money, completely different. Dues money, no politics whatsoever.
That was the argument that was made to me. And I have to admit, you are better schooled on this stuff than I am. And I appreciate being set back on the straight and narrow here. But that was the argument that was made to me by one lawmaker who was in support of this guy named Ryan McKenzie from Lehigh County.
And that's my problem with this, John, is you've got a bunch of these people who ideologically, there's an enemy, we got to destroy them, and whatever sounds plausible, whatever sounds, hey, that sounds good, let's use that. Even if it's factually inaccurate, and look, these people are lawmakers, these people who are the folks who set the law of this commonwealth. I don't want people who are just going to be pulling facts out of the dark side of the moon.
Well, I mean, there's obviously going to have to be a public education component to this, because I've been doing this for 20 years, and you just set me straight on a piece of labor law that I didn't know about. So obviously, you know, it looks like they're trying to sell this thing, and they will use what they got to use.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, going back to this idea, and I thought you guys did a great job of covering Tuesday's press conference that turned into a sizable rally. But one of the stories you guys covered was this guy driving a truck around the Capitol that had some sign on it from the Commonwealth Foundation. That I got to give the Commonwealth Foundation credit, the Tea Party think tank. They did spell the sign right. But I found it interesting that they had to get a guy from outside of Pennsylvania. They had to bring someone in from North Carolina to drive that truck around. And it seemed very poetic to me that this legislation, I don't know anyone in Pennsylvania who's calling for it. And guy driving around the sign, I don't know anybody who's willing to do that either.
Well, yeah, the guy might have been just trying to make a buck. Who knows?
But, I'm not against the guy making a buck.
What I was about to say was, I mean, the Commonwealth Foundation is big behind this. I wrote a couple of earlier pieces about this, and I said before it was going to sign Alex Gary the bill, and I got a lot of pushback from them. You know, they are quite emphatically in favor of this bill, and you know, it looks like they'll use what methods they got to use to make their case.
So let me ask you this: have you ever asked Matt Briette over at the Tea Party think tank where they get their funding from? Because here's the thing: I know where every dime of labor money comes from. I know where every dime of the union's money comes from. Nobody seems to know where the Tea Party think tank gets their funding to pay somebody to drive the truck around from out of state.
Yeah, I've had those conversations with Matt down the years, and I want to say this: I'm not going to take a gratuitous hack at him because, you know, I got to walk both sides of the
street. No, I know you do.
He and I have always gotten on well. He's called me back when I've needed him.
You know, so
as the source down, and so have you. And he's been down as the source down the years. But the fact of the matter is, it's kind of hard to unravel where these guys get their funding from. We know that, or at least we suspect, that there's some SCAFE money there. We think there's Alex and Koch Brothers money there. You know, they're headquartered in the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association building over there on State Street. So I presume, they're obviously paying rent, but there must be some sort of funding from the Manufacturers Association, though I can't say that with any degree of certainty. So I presume I should probably not say that anyway, because I could be completely flat out wrong.
You never know.
But
the one, the last thing before I move on from this article, the one thing that I would kind of push back a little bit on in your writing, is you'd written, and it was just kind of a throwaway line, I think, in the ongoing battle between corporate right wing and big labor. I don't really know that we have big labor in this country anymore. You're talking about 6.7% of the private sector, 11.3% of the overall workforce. That, to me, is not this huge, gargantuan monster. This is a very small percentage of the population.
Well, yeah, we're a long way from Eugene Debs, obviously. But, you know, you guys have got a lot of clout in Harrisburg. And it's always been, you know, back to Billy George when I first met him, when I came up here 14 years ago. Labor has always spoken with a very loud voice. It's always been very effective. So to me, calling it, you know, the moniker Big Labor seemed, it wasn't pejorative, it seemed just, you know, appropriate.
Yeah, well, I mean, on Tuesday, if you saw all those working people coming from across the state to stand up for their right and to have their voice, I guess I could see where you get that from.
I could walk through Rotunda, I saw it, believe me.
Yeah. And the hundreds of people who were left out in the cold to freeze because they wouldn't let them in the building, but that's a whole other argument. You wrote a piece today that John sent me. Oddly enough, John sent me an email from John that talked about the war on the poor. And you pointed out that the Farm Bill, you know, may be passing, but it's coming with $8 billion in cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which, you know, I don't get.
You know what? I frankly don't. Either. I mean, you got to do what you got to do to get a bill passed on Capitol Hill, I guess. But, you know, this piece that my friend K.T. Maurice of the Post-Gazette wrote that I sort of aggregated for this story points out that, you know, in Pennsylvania, you get about 175 households are going to lose about $65 a month in benefit. A loss is totaling about $135 million statewide annually.
But you think about that.
I'm going to. I mean, that's a chunk of change, man. If you're trying to put food on the table for a family of four and you're trying to make the rent and you're trying to make the bills, you're talking about, I mean, this is the squeeze. And, you know, you get the argument from the other side who says, well, it's time to wean people off of these benefits to provide job training, to provide, you know, workforce development or education or whatever. And, like, and to me, that argument's all well and good, but, you know, that don't put food on the table and that don't cover the bills, which is what extended unemployment, which is what food stamps do. And to me, it's just a backwards argument. I mean, you know, fine, you want to put these people into workforce training programs. I got no problem with doing that. You should be training them for the jobs that are out there so they can go make a living and support their families. But until they land a gig, why you'd want to pull the rug out from under the people who can afford it the least is just, it just staggers me. It really does.
You know, I keep hearing that frame, though, that the other lazy or the, you know, as the governor
said. That ain't true. We know that's not true.
Well, we know it's not true, but that's the frame that I hear from a particular party. And our governor said, you know, they're at one point they were lazy, another point that they can't pass a drug test. So there's all of this beating up on people. And if, you know, I really, because I don't like welfare either. And I think we should be looking at the real welfare queens in this country, these huge corporations who suck us dry and end up pitting states against one another, trying to get as much money as they can from each of the states, you know, just so that they can have a little more. That's the welfare I think we should be looking at.
I agree. And I mean, I hear this knock that these people are lazy or lack initiative. I mean, there's like a 68.2% labor participation rate right now. The lowest it's been in years.
Yep.
People are so discouraged they're just stopping looking for work. And I read about this the other week. There was on Martin Luther King Day, there was a job fair in the Harrisburg Hill here in town. And, you know, I walked in there and there were people from 20 something to 50 something in their Sunday suits walking around with resumes under their arms trying to find a gig. And this one guy told me he probably talked to 150 people over the course of the day. I mean, there were a couple hundred people in there when I got there, and there's supposed to be about 3,000 or 3,500 people who were going to crawl past through the door between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. So, I mean, you know, to me, this idea that, oh, they're lazy, you know, I saw the numbers with my own eyes. I mean, people want to work. The problem is that there's more of them than there is open positions. And right now, if you're an employer and you got jobs to fill, I mean, frankly, this is a great time to do it because you've got your pick of just about anybody.
Yeah, and if you look at the statistics, what they're saying is there's about three people looking for every one opening.
Yeah, exactly.
So
and we're a million fewer jobs than there was at the beginning of the recession.
And
yeah,
And to use that fact, John, those are the people who, as you pointed out, haven't gotten discouraged and are still looking.
Yeah, exactly. And but there are thousands more who have stopped. And I mean that's just really sad.
Yeah, but the reason I brought that up is I wanted to thank you for that, because we don't see much of that in the media. People willing to stand up and say, you know what, these people aren't lazy. This is going to harm our economy by pulling money out of the economy and possibly create more unemployment. And that's, to me, this whole push towards austerity, just off the path.
Well, I mean, and I will say, I mean, this is something at 10 Live on the opinion page that we intend to devote a lot of time to this year. We're developing our editorial agenda for 2014, and I'd invite your listeners to email me. It's Jay Micek, M-I-C-E-K, at 10live.com, with their thoughts and their comments. I mean, we're trying to put together an editorial agenda of the issues that we want to tackle in 2014, and jobs and the economy and income inequality and the opportunity gap is going to be at the top of that list. I can say that right.
Well, if that's the case, then we're going to want you to come back here often, because those are the kind of things we talk about every night on this program. John, it was great talking with you. I look forward to you coming back and talking to us.
Hey, Rick, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
A corporate lobbyist recently admitted to the New York Times, everybody is embarrassed about it, although not so embarrassed that they don't do it. It is the scandalous copulation between corporate cash and willing legislators that's taking place regularly in such secretive rendezvous resorts as the Dorado Beach Ritz-Carlton. Lawmakers and lobbyists don't like to talk about what they're doing and certainly don't want voters or the media to see them, for these getaways are explicit, tawdry examples of the prostitution of our legislative system. If you had wandered innocently into the Tony Four Seasons Hotel of Vail, Colorado in early January, you could have witnessed one of these group gropes. Assorted lobbyists, including one who represents the utility giant, PPL Corporation, had slipped tens of thousands of dollars into the political pockets of Representative Ed Whitfield and four other House members for the pleasure of rubbing elbows, whining and dining, and whispering sweet legislative nothings to them for hours. At one dinner, the cozy group dug into juicy Wagyu steaks and swilled $60 a bottle wine as they played scratch-my-back Washington-style politics. Whitfield, a Kentucky Republican, was especially popular with the utility lobbyists, for he chairs the House committee that handles legislation affecting, guess who, utilities. And Ed must have had a good time in Vail, because when he returned to Washington, he promptly introduced a bill to let PPL and other electric utilities build additional polluting, coal-burning power plants, an industry favor that would overturn health protections recently approved by the Obama administration. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, the public approval rating for Congress is at historic lows, but the Vail experience of Whitfield and the others just shows that lawmakers can be lovable. You just have to know the price.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
It's all brand new. I'm crazy for you. And you know it.
Fiona is just kind of crazy for crazy. I mean, you look at her and that is, I mean, ultimate crazy right there. It's just amazing to me that she is a United States Congresswoman. That it's one of those things that just grabs you and says, wow, we've got some serious problems. And, you know, yesterday we talked about this Tom Cole, the Republican from Oklahoma, who said, you know, in the aftermath of the State of the Union, that Republicans are never going to stop trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. His words, not mine, verbatim, right from his mouth. They're never going to stop. And, you know, got to give credit where credit is due, at least a little honest. I mean, honest right there. They're not going to. There's a segment of that party that, you know, you're never going to stop Bachman being part of it. Just like they've never stopped trying to destroy Social Security. Just like they've never stopped trying to destroy Medicare. Just like they've never stopped trying to destroy Medicaid, unemployment insurance, you name it. They haven't stopped. And I don't think they're going to. At least they're honest about it. You know, this whole attack on voting rights. Do you think it's going to stop? No. Here in this state, sure. You know, the court said it's unconstitutional. You knew Corbett was going to appeal it because that's what the wealth class wants. Use our tax dollars to pursue something that's going to harm us. And right on down on the list. And now you look at Louis Gohmert, and Michelle Bachmann, and of course, you know, when the two are, you've got to have the third, which is Steve King, in there as well, saying, well, you know, we're going to the ends of the earth. We're going to fight it the whole time. And, you know, you look at this push by these handfuls. And look, let Steve King, let Louis Gohmert, let Michelle Bachmann, let them keep staking the flag in the ground. Because it's much like the immigration debate. Republicans have staked their flag in the ground. You know the position. It's there. There's no backing away from what their position is. There's no backing away from their position on the health care law. There's just not. And as people get it, as people go, you know, I've got this. They told me it was horrible. And we're seeing stories of Republicans who now are going, you know, well, you know, I'm gonna sign up for it because, you know, hey, everybody else is. There are other people doing it. So let me see if I can get something. Because, you know, what I find interesting is both Democrats and Republicans are among the uninsured. And I think that's something that isn't said enough. There are numerous Republicans that I've met who, you know, have said, look, I've gone, you know, periods without health care. I've gone periods without adequate insurance. Now, for me, I truly believe that in the richest country in the world, the least we can have is health security and some retirement security. To say, you know what, we're going to draw a line in the sand, and nobody falls below these barest of bare minimums. Now, there are those who are going to say, well, Rick, one of the bare minimums, Taj Mahal! You know how many times I've heard that? Cadillac healthcare plans? And I go, you know, what exactly do you mean by Cadillac healthcare plan? Because by definition, you know, I have been very fortunate through my work life that I've always had one of those union Cadillac healthcare plans where my union, through negotiated contracts and the membership's vote, said, hey, you know, we value healthcare. We value this security that if my kid falls off the bike and breaks an arm, that I'm not going to be saddled with a $12,000 or $15,000 bill. That if I get sick, I'm not going to lose everything that I've worked every day of my life for. Is that a Cadillac health plan? I think what's happened for so long, and really for too long, is that we have become accustomed to accepting less. We have become accustomed to accepting more risk and more shouldering more of the burden. and this shift of responsibility, this shift of well, the shift of wealth. And at the end of it, that's really what it comes down to. The key focus and pretty much everything I look at is, where's the money? You know, we can have conversations about, you know, just about anything. And for me, well, it's the money. It's where did this money come from? Where is it going? Who's benefiting? And ultimately, who's being harmed? So when you see, when I started working, a much larger number of people were getting health coverage from their employer. And it was one of those things that you didn't pay out of pocket for yet. They slowly introduced that. We'll give you a nickel raise, but we're going to take a dime back in your paying for health care. So what you end up seeing is this shift in the wage package, and you're seeing money being taken from workers via higher deductibles, higher co-pays, higher premiums, and this shifting. And without the Affordable Care Act, without some push, we would continue to see that shift. And even larger and larger and larger until eventually, it's much like the pension situation. People used to have defined benefit pension plans where you knew at the end of 30 years of service, I'm going to get, you know, $1,200 a month for the rest of my life and I'm going to be okay. Coupled out with the money that I've saved, coupled out with Social Security, we're going to be okay. Now what they've said, whoa, we don't want that. We don't want to have to make sure that we handle your money well. We're going to give it to you and let the Wall Street vipers, suck the blood out of your future. So we're going to give you these wonderful 401ks. And as we found out earlier from Dr. Steve Herzenberg, you know, the average 401k in this country is about $15,000. Not something you're going to retire on. Not something you're going to have a rich golden year with. Not even a year. We're not talking your golden years. We're just talking a year. So I find it disheartening. I find it troubling. But what's even scarier is that there are people who would vote for Michelle Bachmann. There are people who would vote for Louis Gohmert or Steve King or any of the other extremists or the Brian Cutlers of the world here in Pennsylvania who would push the poison that's happening right now. I think we really need to examine who it is we're voting for. And just because they've got an R or a D, maybe we need to be talking about policy, which is why, going back to Tuesday's press conference, why you saw Republicans at the labor press conference. Because, you know, a lot of people like to pigeonhole organized labor and labor unions and, well, they're just in the crowd of the Democrats. That's because the Democrats aren't trying to outwardly destroy them. Look at what's going on right now. Is it any surprise? But there are rational, you know, reasonable Republicans who have been supported by labor over the years because they support workers. And I'm hoping that we get back to a point like the good socialist years of Dwight David Eisenhower, where there are some common ground, where there are opportunities where we go, yeah, that's a given. When I was a kid, unions were a given. It was the way out of poverty. It was the way into the middle class. It was the way to make sure you had health care, the way you made sure you had retirement security. Now, with all the PR and with all the focus group tested jingos that come out, you would think they were the ones who collapsed the economy back in 2008. And the reality is it's the people who pushed the poison. They're the ones who did it. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been discussing how a 1964 championship boxing match had a major impact on American politics and culture. Cassius Clay had stunned the sports world with a pre-fight show of dancing, poetry, and taunting. But when he pulled off one of the biggest upsets in boxing history with a win in the seventh round over Sonny Liston, he made the world notice. As the technology of television broadcast his image and sound, he did shock the world. He jumped in the air and delivered a rant that will never be forgotten. I'm the greatest fighter that ever lived. I talk to God every day. I shook up the world. I am the king of the world. I am pretty. I'm a bad man. Our politics would never be the same. Shortly after the fight, Clay announced he was changing his name to Muhammad Ali and joining the Nation of Islam. Join us again for his impact. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seemed limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So since the State of the Union address, lots of things going on in D.C., the president doing what I think he should be doing out anywhere but in Washington, making news, talking about jobs, talking about how to get the economy going, I think a step in the right direction. But we'll see what election time comes around. I've asked Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service, to come talk to us a little bit. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So, the big news is the president's left town. I guess the Republicans have come out with something they'd be interested in on immigration. Am I hearing this right?
Yes. In fact, the president didn't hit the Republicans very hard last night because he wants, Speaker Boehner, the Republican speaker, to be able to maneuver a little bit. And they have this retreat going on in Maryland, the Republicans, so they're all contained, they're sequestered, shall we say, all together for a few days. And it's going to be a food fight. Senator Sessions, a Republican senator from Alabama, is already attacking the House, saying these people are lawless, et cetera. So it's going to be interesting to see if, Speaker Boehner has a little bit of a wiggle room, if he can do something.
Yeah, at the end of it, I just don't know that the Republicans are going to really be willing to do anything after all of these years of their entrenched opposition.
Well, that's true, but they're going to have to come to terms with the fact that, this isn't going to go away. They can make some changes, but again, they're not even getting to that level because, here's the Senate already just hammering the House leadership on the issue. The Senate should let the House do what it wants to do, and then the Senate can do what it wants to do. They somehow think it's going to destroy their elections in the Senate, and I know everybody's all focused on the Senate, but just the Republicans are going to have to do something or they're going to completely lose the Hispanic vote.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. But, since you brought up the Senate, I remember not too long ago Grover Norquist said that the Democrats, if they wanted to get their tax increase, they were gonna lose the Senate, because if they had their hissy fit, if I remember the right vernacular, right, the hissy fit was his word, that they would lose the Senate and get wiped out in the Senate. And there's some Democrats, as I understand, saying we should just be focusing on the Senate and write off the House as a lost cause. Am I hearing that right?
Well, you are, and these are, quote, Democrat operatives who won't say their name, of course. And that might mean a vested self-interest, you know, some of the money people, let's say, and they're trying to get the big money people to abandon the Democratic side of the House, which is a bad strategy.
Horrible.
The Democratic side in the House is actually raising more money as we speak than the Republicans, and they're raising more money per capita than their counterparts, the Democratic counterparts in the Senate. So one would not want to abandon them. Now, let's say that they can't win the House back, Rick. But they could pick up seats, and if they pick up seats, guess what? That strengthens the hand of the president, because, you know, some of the Republicans will go with him and cut some deals. So this strategy, I would assume some Democrats are going to come out swinging over this one in the House.
As they should. You know, the one thing I've always given Newt Gingrich credit for is that, you know, and I don't know if this was his idea, but he's the one who I've seen being given credit for it, is, you know, back during the 90s, in districts where the Republicans had never had a chance, they had candidates. And, you know, there was very few unopposed elections in Congress. Maybe you'll correct me, but I was under the impression it was his doing to push to that, to get money into those races. Even if you're going to get smeared, you put up the fight.
He drugged me to Washington. Personally, he did, and in 1994, I had a 12% Republican index. 12% of the district was Republican, and he wanted me to run in it, and people said to him, you've got to be crazy, and he did that all over the country. I'm a living example of it, and I got money when people told him not to, and I won. And other, and 19 people won, and we turned the House over. So, yes, you're right. He had a strategy. People criticized him for it, but, you know, he turned the House over, and they said he'd never do it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the one who says, you know, you've got to be fighting where the fights are. That's where you should be. And
right.
The, you know, like, I do my program in Portland, probably one of the reddest areas in the country, with one of the highest Republican voter registrations in the country. But this is where the fight is. This is where changing some of those hearts and minds of people who are voting against their own best interests because they think their party stands for something. But actually, they're kind of way off in a different direction. I think you got to be where the fight is, Bob.
That's right, and Gingrich proved it. And like I said, I and 19 others were living examples of seats we never should have had.
Yeah, but how much of this do you think is just insider nonsense? Just, oh, hey, we're gonna get our consultant fees and we'll be fine, and more just bad advice.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it's vested interest insiders because they won't identify themselves. And they might be looking to make, you know, consultant money on Senate races. And I would hope, really, that the White House would step in and, you know, as my grandmother would say, take them to the woodshed for their comeuppance.
Yeah.
They need to be more of a team effort than individual people making consulting money.
And what's interesting to me is, you know, I've been talking about the last couple of days that, you know, since the State of the Union, you've had a number of Republicans saying we are never going to give up on trying to repeal Obamacare. And, you know, one side of the aisle is going, well, we're going to give up on the House. The other side is, we're going to continue, even if it's our demise.
Well, you know, the Obamacare is here. 3 million people went to the website or signed up. And, yes, there might be a number of alterations later if not enough young people sign up. But this thing can't be now undone. I mean, if somebody doesn't like it, it's here. Now, they can tweak it, make it effective, and make it work better if they need, you know, to do that at some point in time. But the people that are doing the mantra of, you know, we're going to undo this, they would have to have complete control of everything to undo it. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. You know, we did this Families USA Health Action Conference last week. And, you know, some of the folks we talked to there, you know, the one woman told me it took 18 years before every state in the country began taking Medicare. And she said, you know, who thought this was going to happen overnight? And I said, you know, I think the media structure, I think Republicans, I think even some Democrats said, you know, this is going to be here, bang, we've done it. It's it's fixed, let's move on, and didn't really prepare people for the long journey that was that I still think is still ahead.
If the Republicans, and you're correct, if the Republicans took control of the entire government, lock, stock, and barrel, I promise you they would soon find out they could not undo Obamacare without some constructive, thoughtful, well-planned-out private sector reform, which they won't do because the insurance companies won't want it, and they couldn't do it without that. And a couple admitted this week they should have had those alternatives, and they wouldn't have had Obamacare.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing that gets me is, you know, I hear people saying we should repeal it and replace it. And I keep going, okay, replace it with what?
With what? And then the irony of all of this is that I'm speaking as a former Republican congressman. You know, if one wants to support working people, a lot of the people that don't have insurance are not people that are on a government assistance program. They're people that are out there working. The Republicans should have tried to do something to help them, and they didn't, and now you have something they didn't want.
Yeah, I mean, even Nixon, you know, tried to tie it even further to employment by saying, you know, if you've got employees, you've got to provide health care.
Yeah.
Did you happen to watch the State of the Union? Let me ask you this, you know, because I saw, I think it was Jim DeMint who took the Duck Dynasty guy with him. You know, is it me or are there those forces out there who just try and make a mockery of it? I mean, to me, that seems like a mockery.
Well, you know, you have to be careful, I think, with the State of the Union. I mean, the one congressman wanted to throw the reporter off the balcony, which would have, you know, killed the reporter. And when you see these things going on, I sit there. And you know, and yelling out things at the president, which happened a couple of years ago, they are told, by the way, in these private meetings, I've been at the State of the Unions, that people say, look, behave yourself. Don't do something stupid. But, you know, people will do, it's a free country, I guess, they're free to make a mockery of something, but, yeah, you know, you can take your jab of what you think about them, but some of the people just do stage tricks, I don't know, sideshow stuff.
I mean, and I just, you know, as much as I didn't like Bush, and honestly, I did not. His presidency, I think, was very destructive for the country. I just don't think you do those kind of things to take away from the office.
You have to give someone their due respect, and you know, this is the State of the Union. You do a message, let him say what he wants, and then you can say what you want. But, you know, when you're yelling out and doing childish things, it just doesn't cut it, and it comes off bad, and it doesn't help the party as a whole, if either side does it.
I was underwhelmed by the speech. I'm curious, what do you think of it?
I said today, I think the president did some things he needed to do to say, look, you know, I'm going to do some things. If you guys don't want to work with me, fine, I'm going to do it anyway. But I was kind of, it was a little bit of a yawn. I thought he could have stressed a few other things, and but no, I wasn't. I think he delivered it well, but I just something was kind of missing. It was a little bit, in my opinion, ho hum.
Yeah, well, I mean, deliver it well. That's his thing. I mean, he's an amazing orator. Him and Bill Clinton, I think, are right up there as the two the best public speakers I've ever seen. But you know, that's not really something positive. He spoke well.
Well, I wasn't. For example, I thought he was way off track as a Democratic president with the whole fast track talk about trade deals. And I wondered, you know, I would like to see my president standing up there saying we're going to take back America for the workers. And when I heard that, I thought, oh, corporate America and the Republicans had to be jumping up and down doing cartwheels on that one.
Yeah, and the thing is, I sat no more than 20 feet from him. When he was campaigning Obama, when he said, you can trust me. I'm not going to sign these free trade agreements with Colombia and Panama and South Korea, you know, without good, strong labor and good, strong environmental. And, you know, I look at those three that he signed, not very strong labor or environmental. And if you look at the numbers, we're losing jobs. And now we want something, you know, probably a million times bigger than those three. And then we want to do it through the fast track mechanism. Not going for it. And look, I don't care who the president is. Fast track is a bad idea.
Oh, it's horrible. I thought every president when I was there, and we put coalitions of Democratic and Republican members together because, you know, these things are, and they all sing the same tune. we need another trade agreement because we're losing jobs. Well, we're losing jobs because we had another trade agreement.
Exactly. And, you know, the reality is nobody can make a cogent argument why we maintain our agreement in NAFTA. And, in fact, when President Obama was campaign Obama, actually had talked about renegotiating NAFTA.
That's right. And that's what kind of underwhelmed me about the speech, in the sense I sat there and thought, oh, could have really taken a completely different tack when it came to, because he was talking about jobs and the economy and what we need to do to help Americans, and all of a sudden there came fast track. I thought, okay, that doesn't fit in with the speech.
No, and the other one didn't fit in. He was talking about teachers and how we need to challenge teachers and a better curriculum and all that stuff. And you know, he said that, you know, we should be testing kids and teaching them on, you know, being critical thinkers and problem solvers, not at how well they fill in bubbles on tests. And I go, well, wait a second, have you checked with Arne Duncan lately?
Well, you know, this government has proficiency tests students to death,
yep.
And that's how they always solve it. Well, we have to have another test of their to measure them instead of teaching them. And the education part made me yawn. Yeah. I was surprised with that.
And lastly, how much stuff do you think Edward Snowden got away with? How many files? How much dirt does he have?
Well, you know, James Clapper, our national intelligence guy, when he made the statement yesterday, and I put that in the news brief today, when he made the statement that, you know, he wants secrets back from Edward Snowden, I thought, what on earth does Snowden have that he hasn't released yet? It made me think, and why would Clapper call upon him to give things back? Snowden's not going to do that. But it really made me wonder what on earth more he has.
Because you got to wonder if there's, you know, because I've been seeing a lot of trial balloons out there of, hey, you know, maybe a plea deal. We'll figure out maybe some backroom deals so he can come back to the country and maybe give us a little slap on the wrist. I've been seeing a lot of stories like that, and you got to wonder if this is part of that.
Oh, I think it is. I think he's throwing a balloon out there. I think Clapper, it made no sense for our national intelligence director to say, oh, yeah, we'd like more back. Unless he's trying to send a message to Snowden, hey, we want more back, we'll make a deal.
Yeah, I mean, and then the other question I have is how much more is there? I mean, you look at what's already out, and, you know, basically, you know, the stuff that's been leaked is stuff that we already knew, it's just now we really know.
And here's the other point, too. Russia knows everything. And there's no doubt in my mind. So, therefore, we'd make a deal with Russia that, you know, they'll kind of keep their mouth shut. They know everything. I think that the National Intelligence Agency doesn't want Americans to realize what more they've done.
Yeah. And look, you know,
I think
I'm with you.
It's scary.
It's an interesting situation. And I personally think the guy's a hero. I put him in Bradley Manning or I forget, Chelsea Manning in the same category. I mean, their lives are basically over. But, you know, for the good of the country, I think they're heroes in my view.
None of this would have ever been revealed. We would have been sitting there, you know, they've been monitoring angry birds for the rest of our life.
Exactly. I mean, isn't that amazing? They're collecting information on my kids.
Yeah. What would angry birds have to do with catching Osama bin Laden's future, you know, clone? I don't get it.
Nothing to do with it. It's all about control and information. Sad stuff. Bob, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
A corporate lobbyist recently admitted to the New York Times, everybody is embarrassed about it, although not so embarrassed that they don't do it. It is the scandalous copulation between corporate cash and willing legislators that's taking place regularly in such secretive rendezvous resorts as the Dorado Beach Ritz-Carlton. Lawmakers and lobbyists don't like to talk about what they're doing and certainly don't want voters or the media to see them. For these getaways are explicit, tawdry examples of the prostitution of our legislative system.
if you had wandered innocently into the Tony Four Seasons Hotel of Vail, Colorado in early January, you could have witnessed one of these group gropes. Assorted lobbyists, including one who represents the utility giant, PPL Corporation, had slipped tens of thousands of dollars into the political pockets of Representative Ed Whitfield and four other House members for the pleasure of rubbing elbows, whining and dining, and whispering sweet legislative nothings to them for hours. At one dinner, the cozy group dug into juicy Wagyu steaks and swilled $60 a bottle wine as they played scratch-my-back Washington-style politics. Whitfield, a Kentucky Republican, was especially popular with a utility lobbyist, for he chairs the House committee that handles legislation affecting, guess who, utilities. And Ed must have had a good time in Vail, because when he returned to Washington, he promptly introduced a bill to let PPL and other electric utilities build additional polluting, coal-burning power plants, an industry favor that would overturn health protections recently approved by the Obama administration. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, the public approval rating for Congress is at historic lows, but the Vail experience of Whitfield and the others just shows that lawmakers can be lovable. You just have to know the price.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters, Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes, the poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a
Yes, God is a Republican, and he hates those children. But he loves Chris Christie. And the Christie thing is really kind of, wow, taken on sort of a life of its own, because you look at Governor Christie's sudden cancellation of a $68 million Hurricane Sandy contract in 2012. That's led two congressmen, two of the New Jersey congressmen, to request a federal investigation into what Christie was doing. Pallone and Bill Pascrell, both Democrats from New Jersey, said in a letter to HUD Wednesday that there's no reason given that they canceled this. And the New York Times had a lengthy detailing of it, of how, you know, pressure mounted for a development project in Hoboken, citing newly obtained emails that were sent among the participants. Mayor Don Zimmer has alleged that Sandy relief was dependent on her approval of the project. And, you know, you look at all of this stuff and you got to, it's all that shady back room, that politics stuff that, well, you know, not quite the stomach for. It's very, very interesting to me to see how the Christie world and how he's fallen from grace. It's one of those things that makes you go, could have been president, could have been a contender, could have been a somebody. But you know, hey, this is what power and fame do go to your head. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. That's how you get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Thanks for being here. We'll see you tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like a tide flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious.